Okay. How's it? Is the needle working?
Yes.
Okay, just let it go. It's going to stay in there.
All right.
How's that?
Fine.
Is it working?
Yeah. Yes, it is. It moves when you talk.
How far does it move?
Well, not...
Okay.
Right.
Is the needle registering?
Yes, it is. Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
That's going to pick that up.
Yeah.
Okay, that's fine. It's fine.
Mm-hmm. All right.
It's working, yeah?
Yeah. All yeah, right. It is. Okay. Yeah. When did you get the first idea of the fast?
Well,
of that fast.
I really don't know. Because see, it runs together with the other fast that I had had. Now I have to tell you a little bit of the other fast to give you an idea. I don't know when I got the idea, because the idea was transmitted from the last fast, second to last fast, into this other one.
Well, I remember the second to last.
You remember the second to last?
Yeah, I was here when you were on that one.
You found out about that one?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I had another one before that one.
Well, maybe that was the one I found out.
No, I think no one found out about that one except me. And
oh.
That was for 4 days.
Oh, yeah.
And I had many for 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
But we had one for 4 days in I don't remember the time now, but when we had that session over in Tracy.
Oh yeah.
I was very discouraged.
Yeah.
But I came home and I had a 4-day fast, and it did a lot for me, you know. And physically, I felt it, you know.
Yeah.
That's where you feel the most.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I didn't make too many discoveries in that one, but I one thing was that I was getting very impatient. And I was becoming very ineffective because I'm getting impatient with myself, and I couldn't. I knew I was not. I was beginning to flow, and I knew it, and I couldn't control it.
Yeah.
And it reminded me very much of Malcolm X's book, you know, in that period when he's flowing.
Yeah.
As I was reading, I was thinking, well, a fast would have settled him down. So that must have been in 64 or 63, or so was it 62?
No, I think it was 63.
63.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, about a week or 2 weeks from when I talked to you, I came, and I was pretty good after I talked to you for about a week, you know. But then I began to get this, it wasn't really discouragement, you know.
Just kind of a feeling of uncertainty.
Not even uncertainty, just the losing the patience. That was it, patience, you know. With, you know, knowing that I knew inside of me that it's going to take a long time, it had to be done slowly in order to be done at all.
Mm-hmm.
And you couldn't rush it, you know. I knew that. Yet, I couldn't. I wanted to keep rushing it, and I was fouling things up. I was
trying to do too many things.
Well, and what happened was, see, I was becoming too undecisive, you know, not making decisions, and
yeah.
I was working pretty hard.
Yeah.
It was about the time that our membership was going down the heck, you know.
Yeah.
I think it was the time, when we had about 12 members.
Yeah.
And we had come down from about 300 members and down to 12. Loose paying members.
Yeah.
And it was very, very... So I had this 4-day fast, and I was pretty preoccupied with my own physical pains, you know, to discover any unusual thing, except that I had headaches, you know, and that stopped about the second day.
Mm-hmm.
And I when I got out of the fast, you know, I see what happened was when I got in the fast, I stayed home most of the time. And no one knew, you know, that I was with him was working. And so I would stay and I would read or just like I can say meditate because I wasn't I was thinking about I was trying to get the whole computer and everything had to be done and I was trying to dissect it, you know, and see how one piece fit to the other one and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have read, you know, in Gandhi's books that not in Gandhi, but I remember reading some of the old history, especially Christian, you know, history, where people just before they went into a big a big battle, you know, or a crusade, you know,
mm-hmm.
there were these fasts.
Yeah.
And I thought that, you know, there must be some reason for that. Mm-hmm. But on Gandhi, it was very plain why, you know,
mm-hmm.
there was. And sure, you know, every time it's something, because he had many fasts that weren't publicized. Well, he did his best thinking.
Mm-hmm.
So I discovered, first of all, that I was edgy and all this, and this began to disappear, you know, in a four-day fast. I also found out that, began to find out a little bit about, for instance, that I was less likely to lose my temper after about the second day, third day, and about the third day, all of a sudden I just, like, you know, when you're driving on over a ridge, you get your ears, and all of a sudden they pop, you know,
yeah.
and your
yeah.
senses become very attuned, especially mm-hmm. hearing and smelling.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't, see, in retrospect, I have to say this, you know, because I wasn't aware of these things, but I was aware just very, very little. And then it also gave me confidence
mm-hmm.
that it could be done, you know. That was in 63. And I remember the date of that one.
Mm-hmm.
The exact date. It said it was a week or 2 weeks after I talked to you.
Mm-hmm.
Then the second one, and I could say that was a fast. We were going to, to separate a fast from a hunger strike, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's some separation.
Yeah.
And separation is more, I don't think it's a motive, really, although Gandhi says, you know, it's a motive, what you like to get has a lot to do with it, but also the motive does something inside of you, and I'll explain it later. Then the 10-day fast that I had was, when Perelli Manetti, when we finally agreed to do everything, then I thought it would be wise to have a 4-day to 6-day at the most fast as a Thanksgiving thing.
Yeah.
And I wanted to do that not because I was asking anything, just because out of I feel, well, I did once because I was, the first one I did, it was very troubled, you know. And I want to do now one that I'm elated, you know, one where I'm really happy, you know. I want to do one. So that one didn't turn out so good for many reasons, but mostly because of the timing. See, I wanted the fast, I didn't tell anyone. It was, and I said 4 to 6 days. Perelli Manetti was supposed to sign on the fourth day, according to the agreement we had made.
I remember that.
But
it didn't do it.
Something happened, and then we get together. So I kept on going, and it was a fast for about the first 3 days. Because on the third day, I found out that he wasn't going to be able to do it until about, well, we were in 7 days. And then at that point, I was locked into something that I didn't want to do.
Then it became more the nature of a hunger strike.
Yes, it did.
Yeah.
It became more of a, it was very, very difficult. I was I lost my temper. I didn't eat.
Yeah.
I got very weak.
Yeah.
Very irritable.
Yeah, you used to get very weak, so weak that you'd almost like passing out along about 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
That's right. That's right. I couldn't concentrate.
Yeah.
I wasn't, you know, there was there was no spirit to it.
Yeah. I remember I got very impatient with you.
So I went to one prayer meeting in the country, and I was so weak, you know. But at that point, it had already become a hunger strike, and I knew it, and I was lacking to it.
Yeah.
And it was mostly my selfishness, I guess, you know, that I was not going to get out of it. It was destroyed, it was a good experience.
Yeah.
A very good experience. I went for them and Eddie, and I didn't even want to talk to them. I blamed them for my physical pains because of the, you know.
Yeah.
So, I kept thinking about food, you know, and I wanted to eat, and every time I did that, I would get angry, you know. And so anyway, we signed a contract, and I think I said 2 words, you know, how are you? And I said, no, we didn't, it was a very
cold
thing. You remember me, yeah? Those old movies, I have to describe this to you because this is, you know, this was part of the past in a way, where all of the heirs get together for the reading of the lesson.
Yeah.
It was this kind of setting.
Yeah.
And where the heirs are all one against the other and everybody speaks to the attorney. That's what we're doing there. You know, everybody was speaking to Jerry.
Mm.
And Mr. Cohen, and then I would talk to Cohen, and Cohen would relate to, you know, it was kind of...
Yeah.
So I had to sign, they insisted that every paragraph, or every chapter, or every article, or clause had to be initial. So we initialed, I don't know how many times, and signed the name at the end, you know, and I just wanted to get the heck out of there. So I told them to bring me directly home. I came home, and I told Helen, give me something to eat. And, She knew by now that I was not eating, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And she get after me, and she let me make me mad. So anyway, I ate, and the first thing I did was like, oh, is that great, you know, that it's all over. I mean, in other words, you know, I was happy that I was eating again.
Yeah.
Now, I tell you those two experiences because for that long fast, these two things were taught me, the two, you know. So it took me about 6 months to prepare myself psychologically for it. I just thought of it, you know, and thought of it. And then there are certain things that have to be on the record, you know. First of all, the injunction was served on us, you know, about that time. But see, I started the fast, and no one knew that I was on the fast until the fifth day. And we were served on the sixth or seventh day. So it appeared to the outside people, you know, that I had gone on fast because there was an injunction, and you know, it was a
contempt
of court, you know.
Right.
And that wasn't the case. Mm. See, about 3 days or 4 days after I started the fast, I heard that they were looking for me, and Jerry had seen the document. So I told Jerry, I think it was, to drive me to Jamar, and I go right to the office, and I announced myself, and everybody stopped, the secretary, and just, you know, like, wow.
Yeah.
So I told them, they were very nice after, you know, and I said I was there because I understood that Mr. Jimmer wanted to serve me and I wanted to be served. And they asked me to wait and I sit down and they offered me coffee, which I didn't take. And we waited for about 20 minutes, then John Jimmer Jr. came out. He was very gracious. We went to the conference room and we talked. And he asked, you know, I sensed that he didn't believe that I was there for the purpose of being served. And so I was in a frame of mind because of the fast, I said, you know, I want to be served. And because I'm going to Los Angeles, which I did go to Los Angeles, and I may go to Los to New York, which I was going to go to New York.
Yeah.
I said, and I'll be back, I won't be back for a couple of weeks, or maybe, because that was the idea, you know, a week or 2 weeks. So I want to be served now. And he couldn't believe it. But, you know,
he'd been up here looking for you.
Yes,
uh-huh. Yeah.
Well, see, the whole idea was that, and it still is, you know, when somebody, they want to serve me, I don't want to be hiding, you know.
Sure.
But I want to be served, and if I'd rather be served in their office or my office than any other place.
Sure.
So anyway, but I was in a good frame of mind, and I had learned quite a bit from my two previous fasts and from reading, you know, and so forth. But I knew nothing, and I still don't know too much about the physical ramifications, you know, or mental.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't care to say. Then the question came up in my mind whether I should be examined. We had a doctor here then. And I said, no. If I get examined, if I get an examination, he says, I'm all right. It's not real, not really a fast.
Mm-hmm.
There's no risk. And if I go and he says, I'm not all right, then two things are going to happen. I'm going to pull out of it, or I'm going to be forced out of it.
Right.
So I said, I'm not going to be examined until I'm over the point, the hump, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And actually, until, you know. So on the fifth day, I called a surprise meeting at 12 o'clock, and I don't know how to deal with my notes. I thought I said something beautiful because I was in a different world, you know. Nothing could bother me. I mean, this just doesn't care what someone did, you know, it just wouldn't have made me mad. It was, you know, I was totally, completely, you know, prepared for it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have any hunger pains. I was, you know,
mm-hmm.
And, but I did two things different. One is that I prepared myself for it, and it was open-ended. I didn't say when I was going to quit.
Yeah.
Secondly, I began to drink a lot of water. And I didn't want, I want to make it a clean fast, you know, so I didn't want to have anything but water,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So on the fifth day, I announced to the members of the board, and remember the board, the officers were very kind, you know, but they were, I think, hurt because I didn't tell them first, which I should have, you know. But I didn't because I felt that this was something that had to be shared at the same time by everyone. And also because I didn't want to negotiate with anyone about whether I was going to fast or not.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I told him was because I told him I wasn't going to be able to do as much work as I had been doing before. And then that's where I talk, when I talk about nonviolence, and I said that we either meant it or we did, you know. So either we do or we don't, you know. And I said, before you can tell me that, and no one can tell me, I have to find out for myself. And this fast is going to, you know, I'm going to find out that and maybe other things.
I'm going to find out what?
I'm going to find out if this whole question of nonviolence is just the front, whether I believe in it, or whether I'm just going to get nearer to it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, you know, I learned that, you know, staying ahead of myself, that you're not going to become nonviolent overnight, you know. Like you're not going to learn to be a soldier to kill people overnight. The army trains you for a year, whatever it is, you know. Or you're not going to become a good dancer overnight, and you know, or a good organizer.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a nonviolent thing is about the same. You know, you just got to keep working at it and working at it and working at it.
Mm-hmm.
But then there began a whole series of experimentations and some real astonishing experiences. Now, I missed quite a bit of the what was happening outside. I do know that there was some they created a political problem in the union, and most of the people were for it. I think there were three or four who were very much set against it.
Mm-hmm.
One of them told me that accused me of trying to play God. He's not trying to play Jesus Christ,
yeah.
You know. And that didn't hurt me. It came from a close friend, but at that point it didn't hurt me at all. I said, no, it isn't that. And I didn't want to convince him. I just wanted to tell him the truth. No, it isn't that. I said, he said, you want to be a martyr? I said, I don't want to be a martyr. I said, but I want to be, find out if I can be true to myself. And I thought it would be that. But see, at the same time we had the court hearing, all these things, and the people came out. That was not really planned. The fast was planned, and what I wanted was to have a very quiet fast. I wanted to, see, I made some mistakes with the technical mistakes about the press, and I thought we could keep it quiet. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I wanted the members of the strikers to know it, because they had a right to know.
Sure.
But it didn't. We didn't keep it quiet. And the more we tried to keep it quiet,
yeah,
we there came a point where we had to lie, you know. And that wasn't a lie, especially, you know, well, during the fast, you know, so we just hit my head on and said, yes, in the fast. But I didn't have anybody take pictures inside. I think there was one picture taken. I didn't talk to the press, didn't make any recordings. But I talked to thousands of workers. But they came later. Then, you know, I told the workers that, this is my fifth day, that I was going to walk, that the appropriate place should be our 40 acres. And I just had a notion that there was some space there. I hadn't prepared that. I knew, somehow I knew it was going to, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, everybody was pretty, what's the word, astounded?
Mm-hmm. Shocked.
Shocked, I guess. But the only one that that reacted, about a day or 2 days before, this is the fifth day, Helen had noticed something, you know, and she had said something about, are you, she said, you're on one of those crazy fasts again, and you're going to get sick, and if you get sick, I'm going to take care of you, you know, too. And I said, I just left. I didn't, you know,
mm-hmm.
I didn't want to say I'm not, I didn't want to say I was, you know, unless she,
yeah,
you know, she pushed me.
Mm-hmm.
Because I wanted everybody, you know, at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
But
she knew.
She knew. Sure, she knew. She knew, she just knew by, you know,
sure.
She knows me. So anyway, then I told him that I would, but I would conduct as much business as I could out of that would have to be in bed most of the time because I wanted to conserve my energy. I somehow knew it was going to be a long fast. I could do it. I felt, you know, I can't do it now, but I felt that I could do it.
Mm-hmm.
I was just, you know, ready for it.
Yeah.
How I got there psychologically, I don't know if it's interesting or not.
Sure is.
Well, I guess meditation and prayer has something to do with it, but also some real, actually, you know, drawing from the two actual experiences that I have had, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I was just bouncing one against the other and wondering, why at this stage, you know, and at this stage and so forth. And I had experienced, oh, I'm going to leave a lot of things out because kind of the ideas are coming in. I had experienced, after the second day, very, very, a lot of pains here in my muscles, you know, both
mm-hmm.
legs.
Mm-hmm.
Just, you know, like, well, hungry muscles, you know,
mm-hmm.
mostly in my legs. And I remember, you know, about the seventh day the hunger strike, it was nigabe ni gallina, you know. I remember getting up and being so annoyed, you know, because I couldn't sleep all night with real cramps, you know, on my legs, this part here.
Yeah.
This part here,
mm-hmm.
mostly, and my arms here.
Mm-hmm.
And I later found out from the doctor who told me that this was, well, you know, the muscles were hungry, you know.
Yeah.
And I experienced that on my last fast. They were from the sixth or seventh day to about the 12th day. There were times that it's very painful, but I was prepared for it.
Yeah.
I just sailed right through it. I didn't care about the pain. It was there,
yeah.
And I felt it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I had, I knew it was going to happen. I was waiting for it, you know. And then the only thing I didn't know was how long I was going to be there. But I kept myself very busy, very busy. I kept having meetings, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And gradually I began to decrease the activities. I began to get weaker, you know.
Yeah.
But the 11th or 12th day, it passed. And then I went into a, all I can describe it like a beautiful
floating
feeling, of like I was in space, you know.
Yeah.
And then I began to see people. And something that I saw people, I'm ashamed to repeat in some form, things that I saw were very beautiful. It's just, but they have to, I guess they have to be said. Some of the things that I feel very ashamed to say is that I begin to see people eat. And I had never noticed, and even now, you know, I try to, when people were eating together and I look at, like, you know, look at my kids, or if I'm reading, you know, I look at people, just concentrate on seeing them eat, and I can't get that, the depth, you know, that I had when about my seventh, like, 11th or 12th day. I stopped people eating sandwiches, and they reminded me of, it was such a singular act. Like nothing, like they were looking at the food. You could see it in their face, in their eyes, you know, and emotions, that the only thing they were thinking of at the moment was eating, you know.
Yeah.
Especially when they ate, you know, eating sandwiches.
Yeah.
And so it reminded me pretty much of Mala Comparación, animals. And I get kind of, when I got that feeling, I felt bad, you know, that I should feel this about a human being, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But that was a real strong reaction that I saw it. And I don't know whether somehow I was sort of mad that they were eating. I didn't feel the way. I felt, you know, perfectly. I wasn't hungry. I didn't want to eat. But that was the. So then I said, well, maybe I should see someone that I love very much eat, you know. So I made it a point to have Helen come and eat there so I could see her.
Uh-huh.
And I said, well, the other people were, you know, they're members and I like them. So, but Helen, you know, I want her. So I saw her and I got the same.
Same thing.
It was so, because, you know, it's such a singular act. When you're buying a food like this,
yeah.
Everything is concentrated on that, you know.
Yeah.
And I never seen people, and during the fast, I never saw people concentrate or become so singular, you know. That's when they're eating. And I saw them writing and speaking and all, you know.
Yeah.
But not that one act, you know, was different.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then I called in the three smaller ones, and I watched them eat, you know. And they were more so. And they reminded me like a little puppies, you know.
Yeah.
And Helen reminded me of a little of a dog, you know.
Yeah.
Or a cat,
mm-hmm.
like a cat, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Something in between. I was kind of ashamed, you know, that I was feeling this.
Yeah.
That I kept this feeling, you know, so I was trying to get rid of it. Whether I felt bad, you know, but it was there, you know. Anyway. And then I began to experience hearing.
Heightened perception.
And there's an episode there when I don't know if Richard told you about this. They tell you about let me describe the room. In the room's about.
I was there.
You were there.
Yeah.
So you know how it's very small.
Yeah. Almost like a cell.
Like a cell, yes. It has a window which is fireproof.
Oh.
It's a metal window, which at the same time is almost soundproof. It has a door that's fireproof. In other words, if a fire, the whole wall is what they call a firewall.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm.
And the door fits, so it creates a real strong sound barrier. In other words, it's a real strong...
when it's closed, you mean?
When it's closed, yes.
Yeah.
You can hardly hear people talking outside. You can, but you're not too far away.
Mm-hmm.
Is Jerry Cohen wanted to call back?
All right. I'm describing the cell. Now, that wall has, see, that wall is about 16 inches wide. It has, it has reinforced concrete in the middle, and it has bricks, adobe on either end, on either side. So it's about 16 inches, I think. And when you close the door, it's what they call a fire-resistant door, you know. And the whole wall is for the purpose of separating the fire starts in the sand, you know, it would be very hard to go through. And it's also the wall, a retainer wall, so it keeps the building from tilting, you know, and so forth. Well, we're there, I don't know if Richard told you about this, but we're there one night, and they may not remember this.
You don't mean about the two guys who were drinking the wine?
The singing?
Yeah.
Did he tell you about
that? No, he didn't tell me about the singing. Go ahead.
Yeah, well... Well, that was about 11. It was after the Mass, and I was in very, well, I was in very good spirits throughout. There was never a moment, you know, that I can remember. But he was there, and the pressure was being to build. My dad was had just come that night, and he was very afraid. He also went on a fast, you know.
I know, younger. You told me.
So it was, you know. And so I told him, you know, you went on a fast. He said, yeah, but I was having something. You're not having yogurt. I was having lemon, you know, lemonade. You're not having anything. I said, same thing with water, you know. And it became a real source of pressure on me.
Yeah.
And Helen was beginning to get worried. Not Chip's past the stage where she was, you know, mad, you know, or sore or... Well, that's not the word. She was not really mad, you know, but she was like saying, you know... Like
she wasn't hysterical anymore.
Yeah. You? And so she began to get very worried in a very serious way. And Richard was there trying to, you know, they were being very kind. They didn't want to tell me to not to fast.
This was after about the, what, maybe 12th
day? 12th day, yeah. That's when it started. The real pressure started on the 17th day. Now, I'll talk, you remind me, I'll talk about that. But it was about it.
I was there then.
You were there?
Yeah,
after seven,
New York.
After 7 o'clock, after the evening service. We had a beautiful service where the first time in the history of Mexican Americans, I guess, a Mexican American Pentecostal preacher had said the homily at a Mass. You know.
Oh, that's the one from Parlier or Reilly or something?
From Early Mark.
Early Mark, yeah.
And all that evening, as this was happening, and then he brought with him, you know, a group of from his church, and they sang. Yeah. And he was right next to the priest, you know, and all this time I was thinking of all the days in CSO and all the misery that we went through because the Catholics didn't like the Protestants. Remember, like in Madeira? And I was thinking, you know,
sure do.
I was thinking, you know, to show you that the cause is bigger than these differences, you know. People were there, and I'll talk about Baby Make a Note later on. Having the Protestant, not only Protestant, but the Pentecostal Mexican American.
Yeah.
That's, you know, really going to the full extreme. And the priest, you know, at a Mass. Anyway, it must have been around 11 o'clock or 11:30. Helen was there, and they were not saying too much. They were very quiet, and just speaking very clean. Come here, Jerry. Okay, we'll press up there. How are we reaching?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what I'm trying to describe it's very hard to hear people outside. You can hear people right in the door, but you know.
Yeah, unless the window is open or the door is open.
No, even if it's closed, you can still hear a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, but it's fireproof, and you know, it creates a certain amount of soundproof and so forth.
Yeah.
Thick wall, you know, very thick wall, especially to the side where the noise was coming from. And so Helen and Richard were there, and my mother and Sally and Bubba, Bed. And there was a side, there was, we weren't really talking about anything, they were just there, you know, and it was, oh, I guess I was feeling tired, you know, but I was very late, you know, and I just listened to them, you know, and all of a sudden I began to hear music, you know. So I said very, very, I said, Richard, who's singing? I said, Richard, somebody's singing out there, huh? I hope we're not drinking. But I had said that we weren't drinking any in the, you know, in the
40 acres.
In 40 acres. And I got up one morning, I saw some beer cans, you know, so I called them and I said, I don't want any of that in this place here. Yeah. So and by the time there were too many people involved, and you know.
Yeah.
So anyway.
The beer can popping and keeping you awake.
So, and there were this music that somebody was singing, and I heard guitar, you know.
Yeah.
So they all of us paused, you know, and they couldn't hear anything. And then I said, look, it's there. And I remember, I said, look. And they were singing, you know, El Corrido de Eleno. I said, look, listen. They're singing Corrido, and I know they are. And then, this is the second time, and they couldn't hear anything. So I said, I know they're singing. And then all of a sudden, all the eyes shifted to me, you know, the grown-ups. And I got this feeling, you know, like, you know, they told me something like, you know, this guy's going, you know.
Yeah.
They got very worried on those. So I said, Richard, I said, will you please go outside and investigate? And he went out. Opened the door, you know, and went into the, you know, the corridor.
Yeah, breezeway.
The breezeway there. And I didn't hear anything, and he said, I don't hear anything. I said, go out more on either side. Went out on either side, didn't hear anything. So he came back, closed the door, and he tried to change the conversation. I wouldn't let him change it, you know. I said, no, I got to find out whether I'm hearing things or it's really... Mm-hmm. And so anyway, it was about that time that there was someone there, I've forgotten who it was, you know, who it was that came, and I asked him about the things, and he said, oh yes, they're over there by the pump, that's a long ways, you know, yeah. They're singing over there, and I said, are they there now? And I said, and they said, yes, they're there now, can you raise me up a little bit? So I went, you know, and I said, I'm sure happy they're singing. And so, they're fine. So then, the mistake was that I didn't keep track of who was singing. I mean, I knew them, but I forgot now.
Yeah.
But that was how sharp
your perceptions were.
What it was, hearing and smelling.
Yeah.
And remembering. Then on sleep, the most I could sleep, of course I was in bed most of the time, you know,
mm-hmm.
but the most I could sleep was maybe, I think it's 2.5 hours.
At a time?
Yeah. Well, that's all I needed, 2-3 hours.
Oh.
And there were days that I didn't sleep at all, you know, except there were several days, you know, I slept only 3 hours, you know,
mm-hmm.
2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And I was so elated, you know, I wasn't sleepy, I just... And I wasn't tired.
This was, we say, between the 10th and the 20th day or something, the 10th and the 17th day?
Yes, more so in the, not so much. See, the first 7 days were very rough days, mm-hmm. physically, you know.
But you weren't even out there then, at the 40
yes,
acres.
I was there beginning the fifth, at the end of the fifth day.
Oh.
Yeah. But, there was a period in between, and then it became very, very difficult. Towards the end, when I got a lot of pressure, tremendous pressure to stop, you know. But
and you were much weaker.
Huh?
And you were much weaker then too.
Yes. But I was not hungry when I stopped.
But didn't you? Weren't you? Drowsier as you got toward the end, and were weaker.
No.
No.
No. My mind was clear.
Well.
I was weak.
Yeah.
But not the kind of weakness where like you're. Like a mm-hmm. weak, I'm weak now when I get the pain or...
Could you concentrate on what people were saying to you?
Oh, very good, sure.
But you didn't care too much to talk.
Right, I didn't.
So that took
that
energy.
I could listen. And there was the... there's so many things, you know. I only leave 90% out, you know.
No.
But the other thing was, oh, when I left the hall, there was only one guy that left the hall. Now, in other words, he didn't left the hall with me, but he
walked down.
No, he got in the car and began to drive to sort of, you know, I guess they care, you know. And, well, there were probably others that would have done the same thing, a few others, not too many, a few others. But this man did it, you know, without no one telling him, just, you know, who do you think it was?
I have no idea.
Robert Bustos.
Is that right?
When I got out there, he was really concerned. Then he came and Helen started walking after, you know, I'd been walking quite a while, and so he picked her up and brought her over to catch up with me. She walked with me most of the way. When I got over there, I was tired. It was a long walk from Pocono all the 40 acres.
Yeah.
It was hot. You know, well, it was a hot day, a warm day.
Yeah.
And when I got there, you know, I just, there was a canvas. So I just took the canvas and I just laid my canvas. I was exhausted, you know. He came, went to his house and got a mattress. Oh, and a sleeping bag, and brought it for me. And later on, it was Leroy that brought the bed and you know,
yeah.
Leroy and more than anyone else. Well, I shouldn't say there were others that were concerned, but they were, you know, had
yeah.
Marshall and,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But the others were very concerned too. But, oh, there was some funny, there were a lot of, oh, the other thing I began to feel a change in people towards me. In other words, they were more solemn, you know, at this point. Well, I don't kid with, like, you know, I have very few people that I kid around with, you know. But the few that I, they're more, the few that tend to want to kid with me, even though I don't, you know, it's a rule that I don't do it, you know. Not now, you know, since I was a small boy, and I just didn't want to get into that because I thought it was, you know.
Yeah.
Like, for instance, a lot of people have nicknames, you know. And if I know he likes the nickname, I will use the nickname. But if I know he doesn't like, and I make it a point to find out, if it's most of the nicknames are harsh names, you know. I don't use it. If I know he's gonna be offended, you know.
Yeah.
Well, this is the kind of, you know.
Yeah.
Thing. Well, but I noticed that women, the difference between men and women in that context room were more. Men were with it, you know. The women showed. It was more demonstrable, I guess, is the word, you know, in women.
Demonstrative.
Mm-hmm. And in kids. Oh, kids especially. Yeah. You know, they and so I said, people began to come, and so I had to set up a schedule, you know. Nobody should be turned away. I should say everyone, even though it's just a minute, you know. And
there would wait out there in that room.
They were in the room, yeah. And they bring him in as fast as they could. And I assigned, well, the officers, you know, but with my consent, assigned Phil Veracruz to watch the door most of the time. And I like him because he's very kind, you know.
Yeah.
I didn't want anyone to, you know, to. Yeah. You get nervous and, you know, and,
mm-hmm.
And also, and it went very well. The poor doctor would come in almost every morning to talk to me. You know, I talked to him, but I turned away. He wanted to go.
Were the people coming there all day long? Mm-hmm.
And for a while, it was all day long.
Yeah.
Saturdays and Sundays and Mondays. And from far away.
So you didn't have much time to yourself, in other words, until late at night, huh? Or until, well,
mm-hmm.
After the Mass, after they got through talking to you after the Mass.
The Mass was usually over at almost 9. 1 o'clock. 12, 1 o'clock.
Before they
if I were to run to the whole, there were hundreds of them coming up there every night, you know.
And they all, a lot of them wanted to talk to me after the mass.
Oh, yes, everyone. And I told the guy I don't want to be accessible to all of them, you know. And it went very well because there was no hard feelings. The people went, you know, not like right now, you know, where there's a lot of pressure, you know,
yeah,
on one side, pressure on the other side. They were just, you know. And I had, on the 11th day, I complained to Father Cofield, no, Father Dugan's wife. Sally, she's a nurse who's working there. Mm-hmm. She came in, you know, and I complained about my back. Mm-hmm. And, the other thing is I took a very thin mattress and I had a board underneath. So I was laying on very, very hard surface, you know. And, I somehow, you know, it wasn't like complaining, it was just, I think she saw that I kind of, you know, was trying to get up and I put my elbow. I had the back pain all through that period, you know.
Sure.
After a while, the back pain wasn't the main concern, but she came and she offered to give me a rub down, you know. And I began to wonder whether this was, you know, keeping with the fast, whether this would interfere in terms of, you know, whether they'd be more comfortable for me. And so I decided that maybe, you know, since I wasn't taking any medicine, maybe it's just, you know, it would be all right.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I made my own decision that it was not, that this would not interfere with a true fast.
Mm-hmm.
But I had to think it over for a couple of days. So I called and I said, I didn't tell her that, you know, I said, well, I'll let you know. And I called and she came and gave me a rub down.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to sleep before she got through, as I remember. She massaged my back, you know, and she also taught me how to, because I complained about sleeping on my back and my side, because the mattress was about this thick, you know, and the
Do you want that book article? Do you want to keep it? If not, I'm going to send it to Peter. If you're going to give it to him, if you want to keep it, I'm going to leave it here.
Well, we should have one for our files.
Yeah, okay, I'll leave it.
Well, why don't you send it to Peter, and then we can get another one.
Okay.
I brought down an extra one.
You did?
Yeah.
And
it's on the bottom of it.
Oh, yes.
I thought
he'd
like to read it.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. He hasn't been
coming
up yet.
No.
No, I'm Gloria Cole, Bill, Sean, who's the editor. And it hasn't been, I forget the word they used, whatever, it hasn't been scheduled yet, which means it's not going to appear in the next 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the pressure's off. I'm going to ask Peter to write him a letter because I think it would be a good time.
Mm-hmm.
You said they had a crazy short story.
Oh, yeah.
What?
They had a short story in there this last time. It took up half the magazine. You know, nothing topical. I didn't read it. But did you?
I was, what was I? Oh, on the massage.
Yeah.
And so I wasn't thinking about sleeping on the side and my back.
Yeah.
So I haven't slept on my stomach for many, many years because of the back pain.
Yeah.
So she showed me how to use a pillow and how to lay down to arch my back.
Oh, yeah.
To prevent my back from arching.
Yeah. Keep it humped a little.
Yeah. Right in my midsection.
Mm-hmm.
When raising one leg up.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned, you know, to sleep that way. So I began to alternate, you know. And for also heavy meetings like that, I would just remember. And it was very relaxing.
Yeah.
And then there were some comical things that happened. Did I tell you about the tacos?
No.
They began to Helen began to stay there, you know, very regularly, but sometimes she wouldn't, you know. And I think it was one day when something happened and she had to stay home. And Richard and Sally became very close to the fast. She was very involved in it. got a little tent, you know, people began to camp out there in tents and so forth. And there were two or three who began to fast, and I called them, I told them not to fast, you know. If they wanted to fast, they should be a time, you know, that let me do it this time, you know,
yeah,
then.
Yeah.
Then, you know, we'll... Mm-hmm. So anyway, they were not prepared psychologically for it, they wouldn't have it. One tried it. That one named him, you know, tried it for 3 days, 2.5 days, and just couldn't do it. He wasn't prepared, never done it before. But, no, this fellow came from up north. He and a group of guys got together, but I found out later, in a bar, you know, because it became, I guess, a topic of conversation among Mexican-Americans, and a lot of people, but I guess more and more among farm workers. These guys got together, and they were very worried that I was not eating. This was the 17th day. It had just been a big report, and the TV camera has scanned the place, but not for me, you know, just where I was, you know. And, it was a national TV, I think, report or something. We got very concerned, so they had a meeting, and they commissioned me to come and make me eat. And they gave me his gas, and he got his car. And
where did this take place?
Up north.
Huh?
And Richard was taking care of him, but he was sleeping in a tent outside, you know. So he fell asleep, the door was open. So I was reading the Bible, and you know, I heard some steps outside. And all of a sudden the door opened and this guy came in. Ordinarily, I would have, you know, said, what do you want here? I said, hi, you know, no fear.
Yeah.
Fear, you know, all these emotions, you know, it just completely, you know.
Cleansed.
Not completely, but they just don't, they become so unreal.
Yeah.
And he had a lunch pail, it was a black lunch pail, big lunch pail. And so he hugged me and began to cry. And of course, he was very drunk. So I was very weak, and he was a big man, and he had his weight on top of me. He was having a heck of a time breathing because he was, you know, oh, I'm not good, I'm breathing. I didn't want to push him because I didn't want to hurt his feelings, but I had to get some air, you know, because I lent him the, all the alcohol, you know.
Yeah. So anyway,
then that passed, and then he was very jolly, you know, and we talked, and then he told me he commissioned me. He had a una comisión, you know, a mandate,
yeah,
committee,
yeah,
that I had to eat. And I told him very nicely why, you know, what the fast was, and you know, that this was a sacrifice, and of course, you know, he didn't make things, I'm sure you would understand what I was talking about. And, well, that didn't work. Then he tried again, so then I talked to him about, very soon I would be eating.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't work. Finally, one thing that didn't work, he opened up this lunch pail and got a big taco, and he was trying to force the taco down my...
Really?
Really, you know? See, he had my hands like this, a knee on my arm like this.
Really?
Really. He was drunk, you know, he had a knee right here in my arm, and with another hand here, and with one hand, you know, and he was trying to get this big taco, you know, in my mouth.
Yeah.
And I didn't want even to see. I didn't want the tortilla to touch my lips because I felt I would be breaking the fast, you know.
Yeah.
And it was the only time that I felt a little bit of irritation. But it wasn't, you know, the usual thing that flashes through, you know, just a little, you know.
Yeah.
And so he would let me go, you know, and I, of course, you know, I was doing everything I couldn't. He's a big man, you know. Oh, I couldn't even begin to, all I could do was just move my hair like this, you know, so the tortilla wouldn't touch my lips, you know.
Yeah.
And I was pleading with him not to do it.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know whether it was mainly Randy. I think it was mainly Randy or Bustos, Macario Bustos,
Camacho?
No. The guy that got the bus in Colorado. Meléndez?
Yeah.
Meléndez, that was someone, I forgot who it was, but they heard, you know, so he called the others, so they all rushed in, you know. And they saw him, you know, on top of me, and they were trying to harm me, you know. So I was trying to tell him, you know, because they grabbed him, you know. And I said, don't harm him, you know, don't harm him, you know, leave him alone, he's not hurting me, you know. And of course, they weren't about to listen to me. Like, this boy got from neck and the head mouth. So I kept shouting, and this time Richard comes in, you know. It was Richard who came in, or Manuel, I forget who it was. But I said, look, you know, he's not doing anything to me. And so he came, and he sat there, and I said, I just want to just leave me, leave him alone. So he sat down, you know, and he cried again, and I reassured him. And then he didn't know what to do. He couldn't go back because he had promised that he would, you know,
yeah,
he would carry out his mission. So he sat there and fell asleep, you know, on the table. So the end of the storm, so I fell asleep. And that's all I fell asleep when I woke up, you know. Lunchville was gone, and he was gone. And I'll never, afterwards, I thought it was funny.
Yeah. But he stayed right in there with you.
Yeah. And, you know, he tried all the approaches and, you know, all the pitches, and I just couldn't. Well, his mission was to make me
holy.
Of course, the services were very, very, I thought they were very nice. I liked it. And people looked forward to it. And people came, you know. People had never been to Mass or church, you know, in 30 years of going to communion, and they've been at church for 20 years, you know. But then Father said, you know, I've been to Mass in 20 years or 30 years. You know, it was just a,
yeah.
I think, of course, and I'm not a good judge because I was so elated that I tend to think that everybody was, you know. But my feeling was that most of the people there were really, you know, really with it. Mm-hmm. It was a beautiful feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And that helped me a lot. That carried me, you know, through the fasting.
Yeah.
Then the pressure started. And I didn't realize the doctor was very worried. And I didn't realize until, you know, the same thing as with the guards, you know. I didn't realize until, you know, you think. And I thought, oh my God, you know. I thought, I know. See, if anything happens to me, he's going to get blamed.
Yeah.
He's going to be blamed. So, I talked to him. And, well, he was worried because, I guess, I'm sure he liked me, you know, because he was a human being, but because he had the medical facts, you know,
yeah.
Acid, what is it, that acid that builds up, you know.
Hydrochloric acid in your stomach?
Well, my stomach is hydrochloric, it's choleric, Marion knows. Marion?
Did you call me?
Yes. You know, when I was in the fast, I began to develop the acid, what do you call that acid?
If you hadn't said that, not acidosis. Acidosis? No. Yeah, you get acidosis, but that isn't...
What's that, the very bad... I had that for about 4 days. No, very bad. Ooh, I could even smell myself, you know.
Yeah.
Very bad. It was about a four-day
period.
That's
from dehydration.
No,
that's what you had.
It's okay. Measured in through the urine, you know.
The pH, you mean? Well, what in the hell? No, I know what you mean.
Well, the word was very famous to me. I mean, I...
Yeah, I know. I can't think of
it. It began to climb and go up or down. Go up, I think. No. Very high.
Oh, you're specific.
You don't mean amino. Amino acids?
No.
No.
It's, you know, it's at the liver or the kidney.
Bile?
The kidneys, you know, you're not feeding them.
Mm-hmm.
and they're, yeah, and you're not drinking enough water, and they can't.
I mean uric acid.
Is that uric acid?
Uric acid.
Isn't uric acid?
Well, you know, yeah, you did have high uric acid. Yeah, that was because you were fasting. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's one of the tests that they want to do.
Uric acid.
Yeah, they want to do a uric acid, and if you have, I heard him talking.
Yeah.
And if you have, if you keep this high level, see, they couldn't really tell before because you were fasting.
Mm-hmm.
But if you keep this high level, they want to put you on some venom to bring your uric acid level down. Because mm-hmm. that stuff collects in your joints and can give you trouble.
Mm-hmm.
That's where you get gout from.
Gout, right?
Mm-hmm.
Uric acid.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that we're having, they began to, after I let the doctor, you know, take the specimen, he came back very alarmed with this, you know, high kind of uric acid.
That was the day that I was here.
Oh, was it the day? And the pressure began to really build.
Yeah.
And
that was about a week before you actually broke the fast, I think. You stayed on it one more week.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
But I wasn't hungry. And I was confident that I could find another 10 days or so.
But everybody started putting the pressure on you then.
Mm-hmm. I wasn't ready to break it, you know. I wasn't ready to really
mm-hmm.
get out of it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a lot of pressure. And it had I think it had a very good impact on the people. And I think, with very few exceptions, everybody took it for, everybody believed that it was a sincere move, you know. And then still believe because it's referred to occasionally, you know, when we get into discussions.
Mm-hmm.
And there was, now the purpose of the fast, you know, was no one knows. See, I would be the last one to know if Biden was going on because they know what happens if they knew.
Mm-hmm.
But I also know enough to know that the potential is there.
Yeah.
And also know when the peaks are up and down, you know. Oh, I sense it before anybody does, you know, I guess it's just,
yeah.
Not in bed, but when I'm around, you know,
I just
hear people say, you know, in a meeting you can sense it, you know. So that's why we keep the meetings and you'll notice when something very serious comes up, I always come and make light of it.
Mm-hmm.
And try to get people to make light of something very serious.
Mm-hmm.
But that's where it builds, you know. You know, I think that the whole psychology, it builds around violence, you know. So I was trying to demonstrate to the people that I was willing to put my body in it. I said, if it stops, if I can stop it with a fast, then I'm sure we can stop it forever, you know. Or at least, you know, forever. But if it continues, if I'm fasting and it continues, then that shows that then there's the gravity and the seriousness of it. If that happens, I should say it continues, but there were, we're being accused of nails, you know.
Yeah.
And as strikes go, it was very minor, but as hours go, you know, it's enough to, well, the beginning. And I was very alarmed because of the beginning of, you know, of something. And I made up my mind that if the fast didn't stop it, then I would do one of two things. I'd say either demand that it stop, and I wouldn't eat until then become a hunger strike. And I didn't know how I was going to deal with that because I knew it would change everything. Or I would say, I would stop the strike, call the strike off. And no, I didn't tell anyone, and you're the first one I'm telling this to, you know. But in my mind, I made up my mind.
Mm-hmm.
That it would call a strike off.
Yeah.
And I didn't know, I didn't tell anybody that I was going to fast till death, none of that. No, and there were no threats made.
Mm-hmm.
Just that I wanted to see if I could do it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, you did call the other, that Coachella strike off because of it, didn't you?
Later on, sure, did.
Yeah.
And just in time. But this was before that, you know.
Yeah.
Then, there's so much to it, you know. And I should have done this in the last year. There was something else, too. It was, I I have to show you pictures to show you, you know, what it got our people some real beautiful kind of feelings, and they express it through, well, and more of this would have gone if it hadn't been for two, three people who were pretty sour, you know. More of this stuff would have happened.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
But one thing that happened, see, I'm accused of getting the idea, I'm giving the credit of getting the idea of having that big cross put up there.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't my idea.
Yeah.
You know, I gave the order,
mm-hmm.
but it wasn't my idea.
Yeah, I heard.
You know, you heard how that started.
Yeah.
The people would come and stare through the window where I was. Well, sometimes I was dressing, you know, and I didn't have a shade. So I thought, why don't we get just water-based paint, you know, this water-based paint,
yeah.
and just paint the window. The first idea was just get red paint or just paint the window so you can't see inside.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said that I wanted the Filipino sisters to do it. No, I just got this, you know.
Uh-huh.
So I came, and they began to paint, and they came out with, you see the windows?
Yeah.
They were beautiful, you know.
Various colors.
Yeah, they're just kinds, all kinds of designs, you know. Leroy had some pictures, and now I see them, you know, oh, it's just an expression of, you know.
Did they wash them off afterwards?
Afterwards, yeah. I upset. But Leroy had the sense to take pictures of them, you know.
Color?
Color.
Oh, good.
Beautiful. He has them. I don't know if he has a lot of them, but he has some. And they were, these things were happening. I can't explain except that the windows, the cross, there seemed to be more, like when people came together, you know, there was more, like they really liked one another a lot more, you know. You have to deduct quite a bit of that because of my own feeling, you know. But I know it's sense
yeah,
enough of that.
Yeah, so did Richard.
And then let me talk about the night. Yeah. People I've never seen in years, you know, people I didn't know whether they were lining up whether for or against the strike, you know, were showing up there. And every night. So just, you know, every night for, well, 19 days
yeah.
straight. And a lot of people. But, see, when I went to the last day at the park, I was very weak. But what got me weak was that I got scared when I saw a lot of people in there. Well, the word's not scared, but I was, there were just a lot of people, you know.
Yeah.
And I was very weak, and the sun was hot, you know. So by the time the whole thing was over, I was in bad shape. That was the worst day. Oh, see, the fast was 23 days, but actually, I began to cut down on food, you know, gradually, about 2 weeks before. You know,
preparation.
Yeah, and the last meal that I had was a very big meal. It was in San Juan Bautista at Casa Maria or Castañano, that restaurant over there. We had a meal, Bill Churcher and Marshall Gann, when we went to the Almaden. There's something with the Almaden people. And we met there. Well, we went to eat there. Bill took us. And I had an Italian place. I had quite a bit of food.
Mm-hmm.
The last
one course after another.
Huh?
One course after another.
Yes. And the fast was started. That was the last food I had. And then Peggy was... became, you know, succumbing more often. And
Who did?
Peggy.
Oh.
And then when it was suggested by, I think it was Jim or Leroy, that I should go away for some rest. I didn't want to go without the family, you know, so we finally got them out of school, at least a week. And then Helen couldn't drive and I couldn't drive, so we took Peggy with us. And she was a very, very, a lot of help.
That's when you went over to the coast, isn't
right.
it? Yeah.
She was a well, tremendous help. Mm-hmm. But she asked me, we're on the way over on Highway, it used to be 86, what is it, 68 now, in Wasco, over to Los Robles, in the Laurel Hills. And she said, I hope you like to eat, Caesar. I'm in the back seat, she was driving, and I said,
11:30.
Yeah. Okay. So I'll, another 5 minutes.
Anything special you want me to tell Peter?
Well, then, other than, you know, that.
I just said
you regards said. And,
yeah, okay. And I hear you're not
there. And I said, anything? And she said, yes. And I've been thinking about the, quite a bit about the Bible and the suffering of people and the wandering of the Jews, you know, the desert had sort of, you know, made a, well, I knew about it, but I had never thought of it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, without thinking, without, I wasn't, you know, without thinking, I said, I'd like to have some matzahs.
Matzah bomb?
Yeah, no, the matzahs, you know, the
Oh, matzah?
No matzah. Matzos, you know, the matzo, the matzah, matzo.
Matzo, yeah.
Matzo, it's, you know,
the Jews have?
Yeah. The cracker, you know.
Yeah.
And she looked at me, and so I go all over Paso Robles looking for her. And we went to a store that had them, you know, just by luck, you know. So I ate that. That was, well, I had a piece of bread, here, you know, but that was just a very small piece of bread. See, I wasn't ready. I didn't want to eat. And well, during the process, I've been thinking about reading about mostly the sufferings of groups, you know.
Mostly
like,
what?
Mostly sufferings, like read something about the Jews under the
pharaohs,
you know, and then Hitler and
yeah.
And some of the stuff in Mexico and other countries, you know. I was reading a lot of group suffering, people know how they,
yeah,
and how they, because I was putting that in the context of the farm worker, you know, and trying to see if I could predict, you know, get an idea how we're going to get out of ourselves out of it, you know, what's really going to happen. So I never forget, she looked around and she said, what? So, and then she got the word from the doctor to give me milk, and I had milk. She put milk in with ice, milk on the rocks.
Yeah.
And in the morning she gave me bread with, we call them sopas, sopitas, you know.
Yeah.
A bowl, you know, and just toasted bread.
Yeah.
Cut up and then milk.
Yeah.
Dunked it, you know.
Yeah.
And eggs with milk. And I finally said, Peggy, first I said, did I drink a lot of milk? She said, yes. I said, might as well drink it straight, give it to me. So I just take that, you know, I just, okay, you know. It had to be increased, you know, more and more and more to get my weight up and forth.
Yeah.
So she got, the next day, it was a Sunday, we were there, we sat there Sunday, and Monday morning, I was, that was a rough. I had eaten a little bit, you know, a piece of matzah, and I think some milk. And more of my muscles were quivering all over.
Yeah.
The legs here, you know, just quivering all over the place. And all the body, and then I had to get up. It was very, then I got tired and I was sick. I was really sick then.
Yeah.
And I get up and go to Solvang for a blood test. And it took a big range. And my test came back, and I was in pretty good shape.
Great.
Good shape. Everything was fine. Everything was, you know, the kidneys and the liver and the heart. And everything was doing okay.
Yeah.
Then that night, the two doctors from Santa Barbara came out to examine me. They asked me about her second pain about my legs, and mostly about the same pain that I have now. I think this is what it was then.
Yeah.
And so they test me. Yeah, no, it's no good. And my heart, everything's okay. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot more to be said about the fast. I don't remember all of it. It's just...
Well, I noticed. See, I had to take Richard again because that little thing I was using didn't.
Didn't work.
Yeah. Well.
There we should, you can let it go. Therefore, we should talk about, in connection with the insurance, about the experience in San Jose, about burying the lady.
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I've told you this story many times when this old lady and her daughter, recent immigrants from Mexico, came to live in Sal Cipuelas, and the old lady died in the hospital. And they were flat broke, stone broke, no work, nothing, you know. And Father McDonald and I got them found in the California code. I think it's the business and profession code or the welfare and institutions code, that the body could be claimed by the next of kin. And got the idea that they don't have to go to the mortuary. Many people think that it's mandatory that they go. It's only mandatory, as I understand it now. Maybe this has changed. You know, was if you were going to transport the body in a public conveyance. You know, but if you're going to, so we got the girl to go with us, and she signed. And she claimed the body at the county hospital. They almost flipped. They hadn't had a you know.
Yeah.
You know, and one of the nurses. Made a joke out and said something about, who do you think you are, Bela Lugosi? Remember Bela Lugosi?
Yeah.
And so he said, no, the priest and myself and the daughter, we're serious, we want the body. She wants the body and we're here to help her. Well, we can't do that. So we called him the DA. The DA said, Jesus, I really don't know. I really don't know. So we put the heat on him, we stayed in his office. Until he called Sacramento, Governor Brown was then, I believe he was then Attorney General.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure. And the decision came that, well, there was nothing in the law against it. So there goes the body. My station wagon was a hearse. We bought an army litter, is it called?
Yeah.
And we brought the litter into the morgue at the county hospital. And we put her there, and then we carried it out to the car, put it in the back of the car.
Yeah.
We drove away to the colonia at her home. We laid her on a bed, laid the body on her bed. They lived in a little shack like mine, you know, just about the same size. And then, we had the box was made, the coffin. And then that night we had... some of the ladies came in and helped the daughter dress her, and then we put her in the coffin that was made, you know, by Richard Help and Sarinanya, and I think it was two of them. Then we got two sawhorses, you know, those carpenters, you know, sawhorses, and put the casket on top of that, and when the ladies and the people in the barrio went out and brought fresh flowers, and so she had a lot of flowers, and then people came, we had a mass that night, a rosary, and then in the morning we had a mass, and then next morning at 9 o'clock I just packed the station wagon into the driveway, and during the night I had gotten a piece of 3/4 inch water pipe. And I just put them, you know, on the station wagon, and then just rolled the casket on that. Then, you know, put some more at the end and keep repeating that until, you know, it was very easy to do it, you know. Then locked the coffin in, and I drove with
a fellow from there, from the barrio, went to the cemetery, and we had two or three cars with us. And we had to lower the body with a rope. Very primitive, you know. But the whole thing cost I don't think it cost more than $20.
Yeah.
But during, that was when I was, it really shocked me about, you know, farm workers and people not being able to even have a burial. And we had to go, see, we went begging first and we couldn't get any money. I have one. We couldn't get any money for the burial. And then, of course, then we resorted to the next best thing. It was to do it ourselves. That's where I got the idea of, you know, I was doing it, and I don't know if I was doing it because I wanted to be of service, but I was doing it. Nobody just did it. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I did it because, partly because out of I guess some feeling of, you know, of being of service.
Yeah.
But I think mostly out of indignation, you know, for the, you know, here this human being can't even get it, you know, I just couldn't get it out of my system. That. So that night, I thought about a lot. Well, those 2-3 nights, you know, I thought an awful lot about insurance. Some kind of an insurance program that would help people in this particular, you know, situations. And that was the origin as far as I can, you know, remember. We had a similar experience in Brawley, almost. And the in Pearl Valley, and it was in Brawley. I think it was in Calexico, in El Centro, and that was a Negro lady there that had died. She was by herself. And so I went around and, you know, with my head in my hand, you know, asking for contributions.
When was this, when you were down there?
That was the CSO. That was the first time I was there was 57, 56.
No, it was in, 56.
Mm-hmm. No, 56. Yeah. And the case board was, remember Manita de Gancho?
Yeah. He brought it to you, huh?
He brought it to me. I went to the Red Cross and Salvation Army, and you know,
yeah,
didn't get any money. So I said, "Oh, the hell with it! You know, I know how to do it." I couldn't find an extra kin, so I bought my way through that one. I went to the mortuary and I told him, you know, what was happening, and said I was going to bury her myself. We didn't have any money, and you know. And he said, "Well, what do you want me to do?" And I said, "I want you to either give me the money to give a decent burial, or you know, do it yourself." He said, "Well, let the county do it." And I said, "I don't want the county to do it. This is the last. To me, it's very important. It's part of the part of the tradition, I guess." To see at that point, you know,
yeah,
to see here's a human being that, you know, that suffered, and you know, when I make, you know, the very last, at least, you know, make it decent, you know. And in some counties, they don't have, you know, if you get buried by the county, they bury you in the county plot,
yeah,
which is very weedy. And also, not only that, but if you get buried in the county plot, they don't permit graveside services because that's church and state. So I said, "All right, okay, then I'll do it myself." And I told him what I was going to do, and I said, "I can claim the body because I just found her sister. She's next to a kin. I've got all the papers." And the guy knew what I was talking about. So I said, "All right, we'll do it, and we'll publicize it." And he said, "Wait a minute." So he gave us a full burial.
Free. Which is that right?
And I did it again in Delano, 1963, I believe it was.
Tell about that.
Well, this one, over at Jimenez Camp on Avenue 182, a man died there. And They worked with Jimenez on and off for a number of years. And he died, and that was the end of him, you know. So, could go to work, yes, no more, you know. He wasn't worth anything to them. So, I got very upset because I talked to the lady, Mrs. Jimenez, and I told her, look, this man has served you, people have worked with you and made money for you for like 12 years or so, and you can't tell me you can't put out $200 or $150 to give him a decent burial. And they couldn't do it. So I said, fine, I'll do it myself.
They just said, we want him out of here.
Well, I don't know if that's what they said, you know, but the wife came from Mexico in the meantime. It was lucky enough that somebody knew his phone number or when she got here. And the case came to me through the Early Mark group. So they wanted to go have a collection. And I said, no. And I said, let's save the collection to send it back. I think I can do it. So I type out just a regular form, you know. And she signed it. And Helen, with the Notary Public, Helen notarized it. I got a committee from Early Mart and her. And we went to Porterville where the body was, and I gave him I told the man a problem. He said he was sorry, but he couldn't do it. Not only that, but we had to pay, I think, either $25 or $75 to get the body out of just because he had to get it out of there. So I went to Visalia, and I went to Delano. Finally, I went to Tulare, and I found a guy there, and I told him what had happened, and he said, it's our responsibility. I do a lot of funerals for the Mexican people. I can do it. He said, you have to understand, I can't do it very fancy, but I'll do it. And all I want you to do is sign a contract. You know, you're going to pay me as you can. He says, I know she's not going to pay me, but I need this. So she said, okay. She was going to Mexico next week, you know. And he did. And he only, not only that, but he put money out of his own, his own pocket to pay to get the body removed from Porterville and sent his own hearse out there to get him. And sent the hearse, watch this, and sent the hearse from Tulare to Early Mart, and we brought the church in Early Mart, and we had to wake all night long. And the next morning, the hearse came and took him from Early Mart to the cemetery in Tulare, and he paid for everything. Yeah. And that reminds me, Marion, I have to make a note here. Make me a note. I just remember something very important. Can you get me? How's that?
Good.
Good? You have anything to say, honey? You want to speak into the mic? Do you have anything to say? Put your voice there for posterity.
I don't have anything to say.
Say it loud then.
I don't have anything to say.
Right now.
Right now. Say something about the beginning of the union. And I was telling Fred where there were only two people who told me that I could do it and it could be done. It was you and you. And everybody else, I was either a nut or they sympathized with me, but they knew damn well it couldn't be done. Or outright, you know, it just can't be done. The doors are too powerful.
Yeah.
Remember? You remember. And we one morning when we started organizing, sent the kids to school, and I asked Helen, she was cooking breakfast for both of us. And I used to work late at night and then sleep, you know. And the kids would get up, and I'd get up about 8 or so. And then I'd have to help Helen get him off to school. And then she would cook breakfast, and we'd eat after they left, you know. And so I just asked her casually, honey, how long do you think it's going to take to get their first contract? And she just, I'll never forget, you know. She just sort of half turned her head, you know, as she was walking away from the dining room to the kitchen to get some coffee. I had some coffee. She said, oh, 5 years. And I said, uh-uh. I said, it'll take 10 years. Or It took, four days less 4 years. In other words, 4 days, you know. In 4 days, it would have been 4 days less short of 4 years. I never thought it. Never. No, from the rail strike, which we could have, which Dolores and Jim, Dolores and Dolores and okay, how's that?
That's good.
Dolores and Gilbert feel that we could have won, you know. But there was a lot of, the Puerto Ricans were all out. Most of the Mexicans' green cards went in. There was a lot of bad blood. And there were some people who had, were arming themselves. And so I just made a plea that everybody should go back to with her and to show the strength.
She wants to talk to you. I'm sorry, I misunderstood her. I thought she
was. Now we got her.
What's that?
He's telling you about it now.
And so she said, you know, that you wanted to meet with Caesar. And so I told him, he said, I haven't got time. Just say that I'm not home. So he went, you know, tell him that I'm off at a meeting or somewhere on some business. So at that time, I think Fred came and I said, well, you know, I'm sorry, but Caesar isn't in. So he said, could he come back? And I said, well, if he wanted to. So then he said he would be back the following day. And so Caesar was, you know, coming from work, and Caesar, this man by the name of Fred Ross is coming to see you. And he says, well, tell him I'm not going to be home. I says, well, I'm not going to lie for you. You come out and tell him yourself, you know. And so and so that's when, you know, you came, and then Caesar talked to you.
Yeah.
What were you doing then, Caesar? I mean, you were working for...
Yeah. Well, I was working part-time at a lumber... was I? No.
No, it was not. General Bob.
Richard, you and he were pruning...
We were pruning apricots, right.
Yeah.
Pruning apricots for Gattuccio. Why?
Were you in community...
No. What happened was, that the nurse knew about us because we took our baby to the Get Well clinic. I think it's what they call it, or Stay Well Clinic or something like that. And she was a Mexican-American nurse, and she just gave names, you know. She didn't know. I mean, she had never seen me. I think she had seen you.
No, she met you.
She had met me?
Oh, yes.
I remember not liking her.
In the house one day.
I remember not liking her very much when she came home.
Yeah.
You know, she was kind of nosy.
He'd stay home and draw cartoons.
Draw what?
Make cartoons. He bought this book and some pencils, and he made cartoons. He thought it was a real good art.
Yeah, he was doing extensions.
That's what he'd do.
Of course, from the University of California.
He was never involved in, you know, going to meetings or in politics or anything. You know, he just, till he met Fred Ross, then it changed his life.
Immediately, completely, radically.
Yeah, but after that,
I used to read a lot.
This is great, you know. He's a great man. This is it. You know, so I never saw him again.
From that day to this, I've never seen him.
Remember how I used to come back from work and then run home, you know, and take a shower and put my clothes on, and I wouldn't even eat.
That was when you were working for General Box?
Yeah. It was at the summer period, and that they organized the voter registration drive.
Yeah.
So I could be ready.
Yeah.
So when you call, I'd be ready. And most of the times I wouldn't eat. Remember, I would just come. And I was so caught up by it. Yeah.
So
the first house, remember?
He'd take off. He'd come from work and take a shower, and he'd take off right away.
I was trying to think of the name of the fellow you paired me with to go knock on doors.
Gonzalez.
Yeah. And he was as green as I was. He was older than I was, so we knocked on the door. And remember that lady, I'll never remember her name. Anyway, my very close friend, my mother's friend.
Sofia?
No, she used to live, you know, where the store was, at Salsipuedes. The store in the bottom, on Jackson. Then the last house on Jackson going towards White Road, on the left, coming from Elam Rock. Anyway, we started, that was the first house that we, you said, well, you start over there. So I, we knocked on the door and she came out. This was voter registration. She said, she was very, very nice, you know, and very easygoing. She said, yes, you know, what can I do for you? She knew me, but not that well. She knew who I was, you know. And I, so I sort of pushed him in front, and he couldn't speak, and he pushed me in front, and I tried to speak, and I couldn't open my mouth. I was so frightened. I couldn't tell her, you know. I said, we're voting, we're voting. And she said, are you voting? And I said, it's not time to vote. I said, well, you know, I didn't know anything about anything. So I said, no, I mean, you know, signing up to vote. And she said, oh, you're registering. I said, I couldn't remember the word. I said, yes, we're registering. She said, oh, I'm registered. And then she said, and I'm a Democrat. She said, but thank you very much. He says, wait a minute, honey, are you registered? He says, hell no, I don't want to be registered. And she says, I'm going to get it. So she went out there, you know, and I was hoping I want to get my first one, you know. She got there and then they had a little argument. He finally says, oh, yeah. He said, look, honey, you go register and I'll, see, he was working on something. So I'll do that, you know, you go, come on, push him out, you know. So we took him and was, this viejas and all that, you know. So we went and I got him and then I went, I don't even remember, I went to you. Remember? No, yeah, I guess you can remember. A lot of people there, so, but I came in, you know. Actually, I didn't do it. She did the selling, but I brought him in. You know, I just walked with him. And so I went, number one, I'll never forget him. I should remember his name. It was the first one that...
That's not Cuevas.
No, no. And then we went to the next door, and this is where all the guys that I know, all my pals, have them, had been to St. Quentin, and I got out of all of them. I said, let's go, because I knew him, you know. And he's now, you know, there's a lot of bullshit, Caesar. No, no, it's all right, come on, you know, sign up. I got all of them signed up, the father and the mother and two or three of the kids and their wives. Remember the whole?
Yeah.
And then I went on for about 3 days, hitting it hard, you know, and I wouldn't lose an argument. And I'd stay there, you know, and I wouldn't move. And finally I got my first shock. I didn't know people, you know. So in the house, well, that was the time that I was with the nurse, you know.
Alicia,
and she was very hasty, you know, very, you know, prep, you know, and so I didn't like that, you know, and so anyway, we went to a place, and then she knocked on the door, are you registered to vote? And she had very perfect English, you know, and she well poised, you know, and I was very timid, but, you know, I if I gave me enough time, I could do my job. So he was drunk, and he said, hell no, and says, get out of here, I don't want to see him, boom, the door on our faces. So I thought, we're not doing anything wrong. We're not going to,
Dolores.
Yes? So this drunk guy, you know, was working on a window or something. And so he rejected Alicia, who was a nurse. And I was with her, just behind her, like a little dog. And she was, you know, well poised, you know, good English. She was, you know, a real
big husky, yeah.
Super duper Mexican American, you know. You know, she lived on the good side of town, get a good job, you know, and everything. And she called me later on one day. She called me. She said I was a plow horse.
Really?
Yeah. Some months later.
She always called him Mr. Chavez. She never called him Caesar. It was always Mr. Chavez.
Yeah. Never called me Caesar.
But
that was respect. She respected him.
Oh, she didn't know. At first, she didn't like me because I wasn't educated. But I taught a whole bunch of educated guys how to organize. I mean, you know, it was a challenge anyway. So I knock on the door again. The same guy had rejected us. No, 10 minutes later, she walked away, so I knocked. And I said, I'm not going to lose this argument. This is something good, you know, to register voters.
Nothing.
It's not a crime.
I wish it was better where it's not moving around on the
bedclothes.
Just leave it right on top of that thing. That's fine.
So he came back again. He says, hey. And he opened it. He says, what the hell do you want? And I said, look, mister, we didn't do anything wrong, you know? And she says, yeah, it's not that. It's just I don't like that bitch. Because, you know, she was the nurse for the Mexican-American group, you know, and she was, you know, I don't know. Anyway, I said, why don't you go register? So I stayed there and let us go, you know. And Jesse
that was the time we only had one deputy, remember, Jesse Delao? And so I took him in my old Plymouth. I said, no, it's the ship. Do they have a car there?
Yeah.
Do we have a car then?
Yeah, you had a car.
The old Plymouth?
Did you have a morning?
Oh, no. Yeah, it was an old Plymouth. Yeah, so I took him over, he got him registered, he was happy.
Yeah.
And then it became a game, you know. Just myself. First of all, I wasn't going to take a day off on the drive. And Fred, maybe you made me take a day off, remember? Remember, we're in San Diego Courts, he said, you better take a day off, and this is a 90-day drive, you know.
And well, Alan was sick all during that drive.
Remember where you had the gallstones, didn't you?
Kidney or something.
Yeah. And I had to run back and forth, but I didn't miss a day except that day. And he insisted. So I missed half of the, instead of going out at 6 o'clock, or 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I showed up at 8, I think. But until we saw the end of the drive. Well, how many days after this?
That's enough.
So anyway, well, the other one was, see, I set up an, it became a game with nobody, I could convince anyone to register to vote. And I enjoyed it. I could see I could really see, as I see today, you know, I had a lot of faith that voting could really change things. And to me, it wasn't a faraway thing. It was just, you know, one vote, you know, makes another, you know, that's the way I looked at it. And you get it, and yeah, I didn't think of the thousands that weren't registered. I just thought of the ones that I could get, you know, just one at a time. This is why that was the way I was used to doing things. But anyway,
one board at a time.
One board at a time.
One apricot at a time.
But I went, I was organizing then, 2 years later I was brought back to San Jose after I started working with you to reorganize the San Jose CSO. It was a very, very sad, really sad experience. When I left, well, they had those big halls of people. When I came back, they were meeting on the stage part of this, of the auditorium. They draw the curtain and they would meet on the stage. And then I was a board meeting, there were 7 people there. And I said, are these the officers? And they said, no, this is a general meeting.
Yeah, I was in it.
You were there that night? Oh, God, I was sick. You know, I was sick. We had done so much.
We used to fill the damn auditorium.
Yeah.
So I had to go and reorganize, and I didn't like it.
This was in San Jose?
San Jose. So I started. Remember those complaints? Complained about this, and I just started taking complaints against the officers, the organization, the unfulfilled promises.
So you asked them, well, what happened? You know, tell us why you used to fill the auditorium, now you only got 7 people. What happened? Boy, did they spill.
Yeah, then they started.
But anyway, I'm having house meetings, you know, day and night. Sundays, everything. So I got this house meeting over on San Antonio Court. This, in those days I was very young, so this lady must have been around 35, or maybe Helen's age. I thought she was old, you know. Yeah, well, you know, quite young. So anyway, she was...
Excuse me. There's a guy named Pete Garcia. Do you know him?
Oh, yeah.
You want to see him?
Yeah, you can join him.
He's got 2 other guys with him.
Oh. So you're
going
to have to leave here very soon anyway.
Ask Keith
Five if he's
going to
be here. You want me to talk to him?
I want to see him. Find out who the guys are, will you? Okay. Tell him that I'm in a need right now. No. Tell him I want to see him. But then find out. Is he a fat guy?
Yeah. I told you he was in a meeting and the nurse is trying to get you to go home.
Oh, that's a good start. So maybe you'll be here tomorrow and see him tomorrow.
Well, he said, you know, like he just wanted to say hello or something.
Yeah. I find out who the other. Well, him coming back himself first, no?
Okay.
And so I have this meeting, and I go and I sit in the corner. And in those days, I had my mustache because I wanted to look older than I was, you know. And I never carried a briefcase. I didn't like briefcases because he didn't like briefcases. So I carried my stuff in my arm, you know, my papers. So I sit there and
You know, about 3 or 4 couples came and talked to other people, started the meeting. About half an hour, the door opened and a guy, man, walked in and looked around and looked at me and just went into the kitchen. And then the kitchen had something on the...
It's more sensitive than you think it is. Then what you can do is just turn this up.
The kitchen had a, is that recording?
Oh, yeah. Fine.
Hi, Peter.
How are you doing? Thank
you. Okay.
Hi, Fred.
Hi, Pete. How are you doing?
Fine, and you?
Yeah.
How are you doing?
Hi, Pete.
You still mad?
Of course.
How's everything? No, I gotta go. I know you're...
Who's with you?
I got the 2 ex-priests. I want to talk to Father Dave.
Mm-hmm. You understand? Well, to make the story very short, is that the registry? Is it registry?
Yeah.
I was very thin in those days. I was thinner than what I am now, I guess, huh?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I weighed about 127 pounds, something like that. I looked like Mendoza, like Jose Mendoza. So anyway, there was this, you know, poor house, and the living room, we had about 4 families, and maybe 4 or 5 other people there, enough couples. All together, we've been about 10 to 12 people. So a guy came into the door, and we were in the living room, and I was sitting like more or less like where she's sitting in the corner. And I had my bunch of, you know, paraphernalia in my arm. I had right, you know, by my seat, by my chair. And the door, there was a door like that, going to the kitchen, but it only had a drape, you know. So I saw the guy go in, and I heard the kitchen. I never imagined. The guy just went in, you know, and everybody said, when I started, he didn't talk to anyone, just went right in, you know. And I heard some noise in the kitchen. And before I knew it, the guy had me by the hair and had this huge knife, you know, a mean-looking knife, right in my throat here, you know, like that. I want to know, you know, what's having an affair with his wife. Poor lady, you know, she was one of those ladies who was very helpful, you know. And I didn't know, well, like, she came to a CSO meeting. She had a problem, a welfare problem. They stopped and checked. I went and I fought with him. I got the check back. Then I went to collect, you know. She didn't want a house meeting, you know, to do, you know. And she became very interested.
That was when you were going to get the sidewalks and streets for that.
Well, that was why I was, you know, talking about getting the sidewalks, and they're still there.
I know.
The monument. Anyway, we put sidewalks and paved streets, and did a lot of work there in that area, you know. A lot of blocks, but this is the beginning of the drive, and got lights, and anyway, the guy, so everybody left, just like this, and before I knew it, everybody had gone. Well, the shock, you know, it was a great shock in the beginning, but then after he talked, you know, I kind of, although I wasn't, you know, I didn't have any defense, you know, I didn't know what to do, but the longer he talked, the more confident I became. So, then, you know, he was drunk. And hit me by the hair, you know, and pulled me, and hit the knife here. It was a mean-looking knife. It must have been about this big, I guess, but I saw it about that big, you know. I was pretty scared. So finally, that was the first question he asked, you know, and she was over there, the poor lady, I, you know, hardly knew her.
Yeah.
And then he began to accuse me of having an affair with her. And, oh, God. I thought, if he believes it, he'll kill me, you know. So that was, I was really, if he believes it, he'll kill me, you know.
And then suddenly you realize, well, I'm still alive, so he must not believe me.
So anyway, he talked himself out of it, you know, and finally he put the knife down, and then, you know, we had a long meeting. Well, it turned out to be, he was a very close friend of my father. So 3 days later, I was over at my dad's house, came to see him, and who walks in but this guy.
Yeah.
And my dad gets up and to introduce him to me, and he looked at me and he just turned red, you know. I said, we've met. That's all I said. He said, yeah. Ya nos conocemos, ¿verdad? And he said, yeah, you know, he was very embarrassed. I got him in his memories afterwards, both of them. But,
yeah, but didn't he break down or something?
Well, afterwards.
Yeah.
Afterwards, he put the knife down, you know, we had a meeting, and, you know, I had a frankie cry, and, you know.
Yeah.
I hugged him, you know, he came out of the car, but I wasn't safe. until I started the car, you know, and I let the clutch out, and I was still, yeah, I got home, I go, you know what, you know, to me? No, you won't believe it, you know, I was really scared.
And you were mad, too.
Well, afterwards, I was mad. Not then, you know. Afterwards, you know.
Yeah.
So, from that day on, you know, I go to, when I go to a house meeting, I just, you know, survey around. I try, I want to be there first, get the right spot, and have something to defend my, you know. I was thinking, if I had a chair or something to put in front of him, you know. But, God, I'll never forget how, but that isn't as bad as the one, you know, the one that used to play with me and it really hurt me was the one in Oakland. This is my first project and having house meetings. I'm very scared of people, you know, and you know, well, I feel very incompetent and all these things. I'm just learning. But I'm there, you know. It takes a long while to get to the house, but I'm still in the house, you know, and I'm sitting in the corner. I'm very quiet. You know, these women and men, you know, in this big city, Oakland. Remember in Oakland? It was then all of West Oakland,
yeah.
Was Mexican-American. And it was a lot of people. So there was only about 30 people in a big, those one of those big houses, you know, I wasn't used to all those things. So I walked in and all of a sudden they said, well, it's 7:30, the meeting was supposed to start at 7, where's the organizer? You know? And then the lady house says, well, over there. She says, where? You know, one big lady, you know, big voice, you know, very self-assured. And she says, where is he? And the lady house says, well, there, Mr. Chavez. She says, you mean that little rat? Or something to the effect, ratoncito, you know? God, you know. He's going to talk to us, this chamaco mocoso, you know?
Yeah.
That snotty kid, you know, but in a different sense. You know,
yeah.
Snotty means, you're too young to clean your nose, you know.
Yeah.
What are you going to tell us?
That
right behind us. So, I was embarrassed, I was mad, you know. I said, I'll show that bitch, I'll kill him. So I had a good house meeting. And after the meeting, he says, well, you speak very well.
What did you do in the house meetings? I mean, what was the object? What did you tell them?
Well, like what we used to do in the union in the beginning, to, you know, explain in detail what we're trying to do, and then get other people to have meetings, and create a chain. That's what we did in the union in the beginning, and that's what we should be doing now. We're not doing. But anyway, so after the road strike, we went into, Gilbert went over to
Woodville,
and it was about a week after we called off the road strike that there was a group of workers, I think Esther Urendi was in that group, out in the Martin Ranch. That's the furthest ranch that's further than Jimara out on Lucor, further out, about, I guess, about 800 acres of grapes out there. And they had a beef, you know, so they wanted to see Gilbert over in Woodville. And Gilbert came into the farm, and said, what's going on? And they got into an argument with the boss. And then the owner came in, Michael came in, and Gilbert had a big argument with a big fellow inside the field. So Gilbert went out to the car and got on top of his old car. Remember that black Plymouth? And he got on top and he shouted, everybody walked out of the field. So I was frightened. I'm sure Jim was frightened. So Jim said, what do we do now?
Was he loaded?
Yeah, I guess he was. So what do we do now? And I said, God. Oh no, Jesus. What? And so, you know. And so here we have another strike. So that was a miserable, lonely strike. At the very end, you know, the only ones picketing were Jim and myself, Helen sometimes in the morning, Dolores, you know. And we were so, it's good that we had those strikes before this one.
We learned
bitter, bitter, bitter lessons. We stopped there in the door, in the gate, you know, we told, please, you know, please don't go in, you know. And then talk about violence, you know. That's where I began to think, boy, one day they can be killed. A lot of people. I know why they kill people. You know, going through picket lines. That's when I began to get very frightened about having a big strike. Well, that was in May.
Because you felt
June.
Like doing a little butchering yourself sometimes.
Oh, this awful feeling that that you get when they go right through your line. And not so much when they're looking, but when they stop and they ha ha ha, they laugh at you and they go right through. You know, it's tremendous.
Yeah.
You gotta have this. No, either know what you're doing or have, you know, well, you know, you know what you're doing. Of course, you don't get that mad, you know. But that was in the early days. One guy came to San Francisco, a reporter, a photographer, and took a picture of me in back of the Volvo. And it looks pretty damn lonely. I was the only one at that gate that morning. And it was very, well, there were others, you know, other gates. There were a million gates, but I was the only one there, you know. And it looked... And he starts this. It's a very lonely, that's how he captioned the picture, a very lonely spot, a very lonely man. And we were lonely, plenty lonely. Every time I see a picture, I... And we had a meeting with, Gilbert had a meeting with Martin, and Martin said he wasn't against unions, but he was going to sign, and we couldn't put the pressure on him. And then we began to bring in the green carders, and the whole bit, you know.
But
we stayed with
the workers stay out?
The original workers stayed out. Then we went after the labor contractor who they got a labor contractor to bring workers in. We went to Visalia and did a character assassination of the labor of the contractor. No, well, we just call him a Judas. He was a scab, and we distributed about 1,000 leaflets in all Visalia. The guy was so shocked, you know. He quit. And not only that, but he quit being a labor contractor. Yeah. And then 2 weeks later, I had to go into that home to have a house meeting and apologize to him. And I did.
Yeah.
I looked after him and said he was a brave man. And not only that, but then when the strike started, he was the first one to have a party at his home. And we raised about $600 there.
Oh,
he
did. Huh.
Yeah.
Where's he now?
Visalia, Mexican American. One of his son used to work with Peter Garcia.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But that was the, oh, it was a real... You know, it's an impact, never happened before, you know. Well, we had all my kids out there, and Dolores' kids, and, you know, just, we plastered that damn color and went on the radio and really, really let him have it. And he, man, I don't know. You know who scabbed on us? Remember the American Food Service Committee, co-op, workers' co-op, remember?
Yeah.
They wanted to scab on us. Dirty bastard, you know, that guy ran the outfit, you know.
Yeah.
It was a, oh boy, what a mess. It was the friend's fault, you know, but he wanted to scab on us. And then, the strike lasted about two, three weeks. And then it was the thinning was all over and pulling leaves, so we came home with our wounds. And I was very disappointed, and I didn't want any more strike.
Was that in the table grapes?
Table grapes, yeah. Well, in July, August, and September. 3 months later, we were up to our necks.
Well, was it right after that that you? Was it after that strike that you got pneumonia? Or
right after that strike.
Mm-hmm.
Right after that strike.
Well, right before the other strike started, huh?
It was before...
You're talking about May of 65?
May of 65, yes.
So the Roe strike was first.
Yeah.
And then the Martin Ranch.
Martin Ranch. Mm-hmm. Now, the Roe strike, we had every man signed up to go. We had a ceremony up in the church, and then we passed out a crucifix, and, you know, and everybody swore on the crucifix not to break the strike. We said a prayer. We threw everything we could. All the psychological stuff, you know.
Yeah.
And then I asked him that, I told him that we should send back the two irrigators. See, this course, they'll never know that. It was hotter than hell, you know.
Yeah.
2 days without water, that would have been the end of those plants, you know.
Yeah.
But I couldn't see how we could, you know, the idea wasn't to ruin them, you know.
Yeah.
So there was silence. And I said, we're not... You know, we don't want to destroy them. And the workers, I said, I think it'd be a good faith, you know, showing a lot of good faith if we sent the then we sent the irrigators back. So the two irrigators went back, and then the company used other people part-time to irrigate, part-time to drive a tractor. So we let two more go back. We understand that they would only irrigate, and they did. They were faithful. No picket lines, no nothing. No one went in. They got a, 2 days later, they got a crew of Filipinos. They got about 50 Filipinos. I took them in Camacho, in Camacho, Nairobi, and there was one sheriff's car in front, two officers and one dog, and then there were about 40, about 30 cars or so. About 15 cars later, there was another car.
Cop car.
One cop car with two cops and one police dog, and then at the end. And with those, there was no picket line. We just stayed there, you know, parked by the road, and we just watched them. And I said, I told Camacho, what do you think? He said, they won't last. So we came home, made a big sign, you know, farm workers on strike, this ranch is on strike. And then we got Roy Arroyo from the Arroyo's place to write me in, for me in Tagalog, you know, a sign. Big thing. So when I showed it to them, and we got, maybe 50-60% out of them immediately just left. By the end of the day, there was only one guy left. Not because, you know, not because of the strike. They didn't know how to do the job. And that job, you got to know how to do it. And Camacho said, they won't last there 2 days. There's nothing to worry about. We had them. So we got the Puerto Ricans who were really bad. We worked and worked until we got them. And, but there were the Puerto Ricans, they were armed. The night that the Mexicans double-crossed the strike, you know, the guys from the Bulgarian charters, who knew how to do the job, the night that they double-crossed us, you know, I knew because there was a meeting. And I went home and then to them, you know, and I got all our guys, Jim and Dolores and Gilbert, and I said, we're going to look pretty bad. Yeah, we're going to go out, have them stay out. There's going to be war. I said, let's see if we can get everybody to go back. They're getting an increase, and then let's call it a victory. Because if they don't go back, we're going to look bad, they're going to look bad, you know, and then it's going to be bloodshed. So I had five cars loaded with Puerto Ricans here that were here at the front office, you know. And they had guns and knives and bricks in the cars. We wanted to go. There were three homes where the Mexicans lived, you know. They're just green carters who've taken over the jobs throughout the years. We want to go and get them. And I talked to them until about 3 o'clock in the morning. All of them were drinking, you know. Yeah. Finally convinced them to go back. Almost half of them said, I'll never go back. Hmm. And those are the ones that are scabbing with us. They've been very anti-union.
Those that did. Some of Pandel's guys?
Right. They've never forgiven us for that. They wanted to go out and get him, you know.
Yeah.
And Dolores and Gilbert wanted to get him. And Jim and I think I'm pretty sure Jim was with me. I said, no. I said, you don't know what you're getting into. You got a wage increase. There's going to be bloodshed. You know, you don't know what you're doing. You're dealing with an exposed situation. Just let them go. The day will come. And they went back. I went and talked to them. And I was very, 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 very upset at them, at the Mexicans. But I didn't, you know, of course I did, I wouldn't. I had too much pride to let it show, you know. I just went and I told them that they had made a decision that the union worked on the premise that the workers decide. And that all I was asking was that they should then get a delegation and see the Puerto Ricans. And there were about three or four Negroes. And they were the angle that were there were foremen and, you know, so they weren't involved. And to get everybody round up and then everybody go so that they wouldn't look that bad. And they didn't, they wouldn't do it. Mm-hmm. But they were chicken shit.
Yeah.
They were really bad. They
were frightened.
They made a deal, so they wanted to see the boss, and the boss gave them a raise.
Yeah.
You know what happened? They got a raise, and then we completely pulled off, and then we attacked them. And Macriao Camacho attacked them bitterly. We sent a letter to the mayor from a town from Tangansequaro, where they came from, and they posted them, their names there, with the undesirables. And the mayor was very mad because we here wrote a strong letter about Are there any men left in Tangancícuaro, you know? That's what we called it. And then it was an insult to them in Mexico. Then the pressure over there got on them over here. Well, some are members now, assembly workers. But anyway, it was... well, we could have won. If we had said, all right, let's go, you know. We could have gone out in the morning, and the Puerto Ricans would have stopped the Mexicans. If they had guns, the Mexicans didn't have guns. There would have been some bloodshed. I don't know what would have happened, but it wasn't worth it. And Dolores was pretty mad at me because Gilbert wasn't mad, but he was disappointed. And Dolores was kind of sore. But I think that I'm sure what would have happened, and I'm sure that that we can, you know, when the grapes are over, we can just walk there and say, all right, let's sign up, you know, and they'll have to sign up. Sure.
You don't have a key to the service center. You don't have a key for anything, do you?
I sure don't. Yeah. Yeah. But then after that strike, Jim and Gilbert moved over to Bakersfield and began to organize the Farm Workers Association, FWA. And they began to do very well. They had, they won up to about 100 members. They had regular meetings. And then Jim wanted to, you know, put them in with our union. And of course, Gil wanted to put them with the union too.
Pardon me, just a second. Yeah. There's some Kleenex in my car.
Oh, okay. When we go home, let's take
some calendar. And Jim, we made plans, you know, to get the
preserved plastic. You know, your alum. Go ahead.
To get his members to join with Delano, so he brought a delegation. We talked, and they were all very good. The Marín Barrera and the good ones stayed in. But there were a couple of clowns there, and they raised hell and they said, "Why don't we get up here? You know, and what are you going to give us?" And, you know, they weren't even farm workers. So I said, "I'm not going to give you a damn thing." I put it right in the line, you know. We're building something. Where's he going to come in with us to build? We haven't got anything, and we haven't got anything. And so I took a vote, and it was a big split, and just barely over half of them voted to join. And we were there with the Deuce books, and we signed them up before they... So we got about 30-some of them. And then finally, we got most of them back. We just work on them. And then we got the insurance program and the credit union, and they began to, you know...
Yeah.
Then it was that group that opened up the first gas co-op.
Yeah.
They got a tank in back of their office, you know, and the car would drive in. Just a tank, and they made money. They sell oil. Yeah. And then we started here in our office. But Dave Havens, yeah, and Jim and Gilbert were over there, and Dolores and Mayo and I were down here. And
yeah, you used to sell tires, you said.
Yeah.
They never even get past them.
Get off the property.
Right. Yeah.
Well,
I was so embarrassed.
They were cheap though.
They were very cheap. They were
$7,
$6.95, something like that.
I think you said it was just $7.
We was getting from a recapper here in McFarland. And we got to be fancy. They gave us a good price. And we didn't know nothing about tires. But they were very cheap, and the guys began to sell them up. One guy put a tire right in front there, you know, right in front, and pumped it with his own pump, you know, and then we put it on, and it both up. I was so embarrassed, you know. So, you know, I just gave him another tire, and I went back there, and I argued with the guy to get my tire back, you know, and I finally did, you know. And every day there was one or two guys coming back and finally stopped buying tires, because they were blowing up, and they were very, very bad tires. But oil, Luis Barraza, who you know has had a lot to do with setting up AFWA.
Yeah.
What's his name?
Luis Barraza owned a Hancock station, a beautiful Hancock station in Bakersfield, and owned this one here on Cecil.
Oh, the one where we used to go?
Yeah. And he bought oil wholesale. I know the trick, so he got me Texaco oil. Not the best oil, but it was a Texaco, and it had the name Texaco, you know. And we're selling it for 17 cents a can. We got it for 14. And man, we had more people. We had a dry one. You know, we sold 80 cases, I guess, in something like less than a month.
Yeah.
And so I just kept on the oil and some of the buys, you know, and began to get away from the tires.
What period was that in, Caesar?
Was that
before the strike?
Yes, before the strike. Oh, no, right after, no, when the strike came? No. And the second week, I said, no, I need to clean everybody because the strike would come in and say, I've got a tire, I need oil.
Yeah,
and said,
Yeah.
So I just sent everything back because, you know, it's too tempting.
Yeah.
But, no, this was soon after we opened the office here, over there, the front office, which we had I described in the other tape, we had a gala open, you know. And,
yeah.
It was soon after that. And then I started the Macleod. That was the first issue of Macleod was December of 64, I think. December 63?
No, not 63, but
64?
Must have been. I think so.
Well, December the date 64. On the membership,
yeah,
because
it
membership is October of 1962.
The date on what?
The first membership card is October 1962.
Yeah, well, that was after.
Yeah, that was after the convention. The convention was on the 30th of September.
Yeah.
Did the Macleod not start right away?
No.
The Macleod didn't start until, no.
About a year later, didn't it?
The Macleod started, about a year later. A year? What's the way?
Well,
no,
was that
63? Did it?
No.
No, I don't
2 years later.
64, then must have been 64.
Yeah, because you kept talking about wanting a paper, but saying that although it would be a very wonderful thing, you'd have to spend full time on it, and who would be the organizer?
Yeah. That's right. We were trying to get Tony to quit his job to come and do it.
Who invented Don Sepulco? Is that you?
No.
Or is he already a character?
We had a contest. Don Sepulco is Manuel. Manuel got the name from Sepulco. The paper, we had a contest. But I liked the name in Macleod. But we still had a contest. And names were pretty bad. You know, they didn't have any meaning, you know, in Spanish. They had La Voz Campesina, you know.
Yeah.
And I had read about there had been one in Montreal in Los Angeles.
Oh, yeah?
And, yeah, in 1913, 14, during the war, we're back there. And then I came back again in 1929, I think. And then Mexico had been one that was thrown out because it was pro-revolution.
Oh.
That's where that's where I got the idea. And the first, I put the first thing, the first copy together, you know. Well, I done a lot of the research for the paper in CSO, because remember where I was trying to get CSO to have a newspaper. But it was very thin, and for 5 cents. And you can see the first copy was, you know, just thrown together, you know. We didn't have time to write or anything. But on the back, I was going through a magazine, I saw a beautiful picture of a building, you know. So I cut it and I put it on the last page and I put our address, you know. And I got, Helen Dolores got better and Helen, you know, I was deceiving people, you know.
Yeah.
It was a beautiful building, I was, you know, by having it there, having the address, you know, I was trying to say that this was.
Yeah.
And I started distributing the same paper all over. Every little damn Mexican store. And so I made a stop in Sanger, a little store, and the fellow people that were very nice, great little store, you know, the lady was very nice, and so I told her, you know, what we were doing, and she said, oh, wonderful, yeah, just stay here, I know. I said, well, you know, sell them for 5 cents, and you keep 2 cents, and we get three. Well, fine. So I put them right in front of the counter where they get paid, so, you know, people would see them. And I just left them there, and there was a customer, so I moved back so that a customer could, you know. It was a little old lady. She bought milk and eggs and what else, you know. And then she picked up a copy. And she walked out. And I said, I'm just saving a free copy. And then the lady called her, Doña, whatever her name was, you know. She said, that's a nickel. She said, for this cochinada, you know. She threw it back. She said, I don't want it.
Yeah.
It was, you know, very thin, you know.
Yeah.
I think he only had four pages. See, well, it was two-fold, so it must have been eight pages, I guess. Eight pages.
Lost your first customer.
But all that gas, you know, and all, and then Bill, and then the next month, Bill Escher. I heard that he was over with working with a Catholic house over in Oakland. The Peter Morin House, yes. And he wanted to come down and Wendy knew him, so he came. And he had an old Plymouth that didn't have a reverse gear. And he had mastered how to drive that damn car without using reverse and having to park in town, you know, we parking there like this.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I'll never remember, you know, we used to go around that damn block waiting for the last spot, you know, the spot nearest the curb.
Yeah.
But there's no cars can park here, you know. So he parked, and instead of parking right up against the curb, he would park, you know, a ways.
Yeah.
And turn the wheels.
Yeah.
So when we took off, you know, instead of with no reverse, we just take off like that down the street. And
this truck's had plenty of cars since then with the same troubles.
Yeah, and I'll never forget. We wanted to do it very cheaply, so we went to this guy who was half broke, you know, and we made a deal, and it was very cheap. And he printed it, but then we did everything else, and you know, we stapled a damn thing, and then we would cut it, and you know, then bring it to the land and do the mailing, and everybody came to. So it became a real show. So Bill Escher came and we were really broken. I said, look, we don't have any money. How much do you need to live a week? He said, $7.35. I said, what? I can live on $7.35. I said, how can you possibly live on that? He said, well, try me. So we got him a house over at the old
Puerto Rican camp.
Puerto Rican camp, which used to be the old Delano plant, you know.
Yeah.
And there was this crazy lady right next door with this huge dog like dog had now. And every time I went there, the dog would want to eat me, you know. He would smell me, you know. And he would come in and we'd have long conversations about 1 o'clock at night talking about the union, what had to be done. And the damn dog was barking. And she'd say, you, so-and-so's back there, you know. It's 1 o'clock in the morning. So we go out in the car and it was cold and hell, we didn't have a heater in the car. So we was in the car, you know, talking about the, you know, the Montreal.
Yeah, I'm afraid I'm not getting all that.
So, it was... So he began to gradually, you know, just take over little by little. And then pretty soon, you know, we used to, for translations, we had to go all the way to Corcoran and build it in our word of Spanish. And my Spanish was pretty bad.
It was only published in Spanish originally, wasn't it?
Yeah. But see, it was written in English. He wrote it in English. It had to be translated into Spanish.
But you wrote it first, before he came down.
Well, yeah.
You did everything.
I had to.
Yeah.
But then, as soon as he got here, you know, I was going crazy with that and all the other things, all the stuff going. So anyway, we used to go to Corcoran. And I'd take him over there so he would know his family, and then this lady would translate it, and then we'd come back, you know, and she wasn't too sure of her Spanish anyway, and it was like I am, you know, and Jesus. Day and night. Finally, you know, he began to get it. He began to, and we took that ill-fated trip, you know, up to, I'll never forget, up to Susun. We got a letter signed by 50 workers who wanted to organize. And, we didn't have any money, of course. You know, but I had my 76 credit card. So we called Mike, and Mike Navarro died, you know, last year. Remember in Corcoran?
Oh, he did? The barber over there?
The barber, yeah.
Is that right?
Heart attack.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, we called Mike and Roger Terrones and Julio and Bill and myself. And so we made plans in Delano on a Friday night. We had a credit union meeting. We made plans to go. And so we said, well, we got the gas and we got the credit card. And Bill had, I think, $2 and... Among all of us, we didn't make $5. We didn't have $5 among the whole group, you know. So Helen says, well, look, I can buy, I'm going to ask Peter to give us a couple of chickens, and I'll cook them. You can eat in the morning here, and then you can take this, you know, for lunch. And you just, you know. And then, I'll never forget, Bill says, oh, I'm an expert, a spaghetti cook, you know, I'll cook me a pot of spaghetti. And I said, oh, boy, that'll be great. I thought spaghetti with meatballs and everything, you know. So he cooked one of those army little, you know, it's about a 10-gallon or 5-gallon, you know, army things, up to the top, you know. When we picked him up, you know, we were in Mike's car. So I had two or three chickens, you know, fried, and a whole stack of tortillas. And then he opened up, and I smelled, oh, spaghetti. I thought, you know, it was going to be. We stopped to eat in Lodi, and the spaghetti was cold. It was just like putty, you know, paste.
Yeah.
And the chicken was cold. So we ate anyway. Yeah. And then we met with these guys. I mean, they're all tractor drivers.
No.
The boozer type, you know, the guy.
No.
They went and they had this Mexican restaurant. They sat around a big table. They ordered. Hey, we have any money? We didn't even order coffee because we didn't have money for coffee. We how much did we got? We had $2 and something by the time we got there. And we were afraid, you know, well, you know, save money. Hell, the meeting came to nothing. They wouldn't, you know, they just didn't. I got disgusted and I said, no, we have to go. We have to go all the way back to Delano. And I couldn't get, I was very upset about the expense, you know, having to go out there. But anyway, on our way back, we came through not McDonald, but Father McCullough. He was over in Oakley.
Oh. Uh-huh.
So we came that way, and then we get in. We crossed into Tracy, and then we came on 30. Was it 40? Out on through Patterson and
Patterson. Mm-hmm. And Wesley.
Wesley. It was late.
Yeah.
And we're running out of gas. And we couldn't find a gas station. So about 15 miles from Los Baños, we ran out of gas. It was colder than a devil. So we decided, what are we going to do? So I decided, I suggested, let's push a car into Los Baños. Julio objected, oh, no. No, one should go or two at the most, the other should stay and rest. I said, okay, I'll go. And then I think it was Roger that said he would go with me. So we said, okay, it's going to take twice as long. We have to walk there and then walk back. But so I said, don't roast yourselves. It was colder than hell. I wanted to push the car to keep warm, you know, keep walking. And we couldn't run. We didn't have any heat, you know. Well, the guys in the car, you know, we walked about half a mile. They were turning the lights on, you know, and honking the horn. And they were pushing the car already.
Oh.
Well, they were so cold they couldn't stand it.
Yeah.
You know, so we pushed the car. We didn't get one. We ran out of gas, you know, by midnight. We didn't get to the wireless about, about 6 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, my God. We pushed the damn car all night?
Well, yeah, but it wasn't very easy. You know, it was 5 of us. And we kept warm, you know, we walked. It was the only thing to do. We couldn't. I never built a bonfire. And you know, it must have been around freezing, you know, around 30, 28, 30, something like that. It was.
Yeah.
So it was the only way out, so we pushed the car. I'll never forget. Yeah. Came into Los Baños, and we had to get a 76 open. So we had to go all the way through Los Baños and then back, you know, until pushing the car.
Yeah.
Anyway, I all got gas, and then we got home back to Delano. What a near fated trip. They always remember the trip.
Yeah, well, I want to ask you, what's his name said he could live on $7.30? What was that 30 cents for?
Oh, you see, if he's being cute, you know.
Yeah, I see.
Yeah, but he did live on practically nothing.
Yeah?
He had $20 and left the man go about 20 months, you know. About 6 months. He just, you know, didn't spend money at all, you know.
Yeah.
And the first great big expense we were faced with was after a while he wanted to come and live by the
Voice building. Of America.
No, over here by the building, because that's where he was working.
Mm-hmm.
And he worked long hours, you know,
yeah.
by himself. He just tore into the paper. And he wanted a trailer. And so we I think we got money from you for the trip. I forgot. Oh, from that only fundraiser we get out there. Remember the one the Swadesh thing with it?
Oh, Swadesh.
Swadesh was
yeah.
The one?
I don't know what you used it for.
Yeah, we got $60. He went and bought an old trailer. Way out in some lake out there, someplace. The hospital was about 100 years old.
Yeah, sure was.
And he took Richard's pickup, Richard had an old pickup, and brought it in the hall and put it right in front of the thing. Fixed it up. And, well, the problem never came around. Never gets any problems. Huh. Until two days after the strike started.
Yeah.
Well, we had to get out of there fast.
That's when you moved out there by the...
Moved out there by the ranch. Yeah. But he lived there. And he began to show a lot of, he was the great.
Yeah, he was.
Propaganda. Marquez is not what they used to be, you know, in propaganda. Mm-hmm. Really, really. He really let the Gores have it.
Yeah.
Beautiful, you know. And, so, but then, you know.
Other things came.
Other things happened.
Yeah.
But, he still comes by once in a while. He's a carpenter now.
Oh, he is?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know.
He went and worked at the educational TV.
Oh.
And
KQED.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And he was, they were very pleased with him.
Yeah.
With his imagination.
Yeah.
But then they got in trouble because they...
Too much tea, huh?
They, I don't know, I think they wouldn't take what he wanted to do. He wanted to do more stuff, you know, and they wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
I don't know, anyway, he quit. No, they didn't fire me, quit. Oh. Mm-hmm. And he's a carpenter now.
Huh.
Or, you know... He comes by once in a while and goes camping up to the... He likes to go up to the woods, you know, way, way up where nobody's in, 30, 50 miles away from, you know, and just stay there for 2-3 weeks by himself.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, just... He was going to take me with him one day. But then that day never came. But he worked very hard and
yeah.
Had a lot of imagination. Mm-hmm. Very nice guy.
Yeah, he was. After you got over your pneumonia was when you began to plan the march, wasn't it? Oh, no. The march didn't come until after the strike. After you got over pneumonia was what month? Was that October?
No. No, that was...
No, that was August, I guess.
July, I guess.
July.
Yeah.
July. You had that... You were laid up for a month at that time, weren't you?
Well, really, I was in bed for 18 days.
Mm-hmm.
And altogether, almost a month.
Mm-hmm.
But I recuperated. I sprung back, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Leroy came in and took a look at me and said, God, you're dying. I just met Leroy, you know. He was Brother Gilbert then.
Mm-hmm.
So he took me to Bakersfield to... See, he had a friend where this, had a friend who was a nurse, Sophie Lowenberg.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, there was this group of liberals there in Bakersfield. And Sophie knew Sister Asanta, and Leroy knew Sister Asanta. Mm-hmm. So they got together and gave me a room at Sophie's house. And Sophie's a nurse. So she babied me, boy, right back to health. Yeah, and she...
So you went down there and stayed down there, huh?
Stayed 2 weeks over there. I couldn't get rid of the fever, you know.
Yeah.
And learn more Jewish customs and history in those 2 weeks. And she used to come in, and I used to. She was, you know, in Germany when the Nazis. They left in a very early part, but she was there for one of the No, pogroms, or what? The
oh, pogroms.
Pogroms.
Yeah.
Then that early spring, we had taken that trip to Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
It was in May.
Yeah.
And Gilbert went,
uh-huh.
Manuel, I think.
Yeah.
And we stopped in Indio, in Coachella, and AWOC was having a strike there. And that was the successful strike where they got that wage increase from $1.25 to $1.40.
Oh, I see. You were there when they were after that.
Yeah. Well, I just went by there.
Yeah.
I stayed there a day, you know. I didn't want to appear there because, you know.
Yeah.
But I did want to see what was happening. So Well, we went around for half a day and talked to the people about the strike.
Yeah.
But not to the union, because anyone, you know.
Yeah.
And then went on over to Arizona. And then came back from that conference we had over there with the... That was the first War on Poverty.
Yeah.
Money that came for...
Yeah.
Oh, what a... And then... Oh, then I called a meeting in Delano of Vista volunteers, and there were some students involved in a farm worker research project. There were about 30 of them out in Arvin and MAPA and our groups. And we made damn sure that we had our guys there. And we had them about 20 to 1. And I had heard that MAPA was trying to get money from Secretary of Labor to recruit workers and to do away with the Bracero program by recruiting workers from Tech Green Carters. And I was against that. Free recruitment for the growers, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I brought them and I made them talk Quevedo and
Bert
promised that they were not going to take mine, they were not going to recruit. It was on a Sunday. On a Tuesday, there was a picture of Quevedo, Bert, and, no, Quevedo, I don't think it was Bert, and Hector.
Nacho.
Huh? Nacho? Yeah, Nacho, I think. And with the secretary getting some money for this program. It was from within 2 weeks later, or a week later, we picked it at MAPA. Then Quevedo and Nacho came to my house, you know, and I threw them out of the house.
Yeah.
I was mad at him, you know, for... You know, lack of word. They forgive me. They had more to forgive me than I had. You know, I was very rude. They came to my house and I insulted them, you know.
Yeah.
I was very, very mean to them. And the moment they left, you know, they didn't argue, they left. And I felt very bad. I was sick. I was home alone and I had the fever.
Yeah.
But that doesn't excuse it. But I just felt that it was not so much a double cross, just that. Here's one more thing against the workers, you know. And I expect them to know and to keep their word. It was just too much for me to hold in.
Yeah.
I couldn't hold it. It was too much.
Yeah.
So I just let it out. I cussed them out. Threw them out of the house. Told them they weren't men and that they sellouts. Yes. But no, the moment they walked out of the door, I was sorry I had done it, you know. I felt miserable. So... By the time Quevedo got to L.A., he had a wire from me, apologizing. I had to.
Sure.
And then I saw him soon after and I apologized. But I said, I apologize and I forgive you, but you're wrong. You are wrong. And then I had a meeting with him. I said, we have to understand each other. Don't ever do that to me again. Tell me the truth. Fight with me, but tell me the truth. I said, in return, I'll tell you the truth. I'll tell you everything I do, even if you don't agree with me. And we sort of got to understand.
Yeah. According to Bert, he thought a great deal of you right until the time he died, but he didn't have any for Nacho. He wouldn't let him come see him when he was dying.
No. Yeah. We, afterwards, you know, we made up. And, yeah. But then,
it is about 20 to 11. Oh, have you been sleeping? I thought you were awake. You've been talking.
Oh, I talk in my sleep sometimes.
Yeah, but...
Okay, there you go.
Keep
we're on.
Another way.
Keep what?
Diet by the day will keep Dr. Trudell away.
Yeah.
God, what a... I can get over it. If I do nothing else, I'm going to learn the muscles in the body. And every muscle in the body.
Yeah. Well, that's called kinesiology.
Kinesiology?
Kinesiology, yeah.
Oh, you want to... Have you seen the little article? Over there?
No.
Oh, you'll get a big charge out of that. Okay, let it rip.
All right. Let her rip.
Rip.
Let her rip, Caesar. We're now moving forward from the Martin experiment to the next step up the ladder.
Well, we won the Martin strike as usual. No, I should say the end, of course, of the Martin strike would be the usual conclusion. It was a planned defeat.
Yeah.
We didn't want to win too soon because this wasn't, of course.
Yeah, moral victory, though.
It was a great moral victory. We learned a lot. Well, we came home to lick our wounds again. And
when was this, in about September, Caesar?
No, this must have been in July. This was in July.
Was this before the Philippines walked out?
Yeah.
Oh, the Martin was before the general strike?
Sure. Before, yeah. It was about a month. A month and a half before. It was early July. They finished the thinning and the work ended. But it was, the police came, but very little. The picket lines were not big, just us, you know.
Yeah.
And they didn't, there was not too much action on either side.
So nobody was really worried. The growers weren't worried.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
No, they weren't worried.
Yeah.
We were worried.
Yeah.
I was worried about the impact that it was having on them. But we kept it pretty, you know, it wasn't publicized.
Yeah.
You see, the workers all walked out.
Yeah.
Everyone. They never came back.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's the same story.
Yeah.
Like Jamara, you know.
Yeah.
Everybody walks out, but they get...
Yeah.
And the same people go out there standing, contractors, you know. Those are the bastards who bring the strike breakers in. Anyway, so we went July and almost the final of August, saying among people that we were breaking the barrier by then. We were just beginning to get people to come to the office to sign up, and we had an active, a very active service program. And
from where?
Well, he's been crazy now. He's not a father anymore.
Dugan?
Came by, and they were trying to remember the plenty were signing up there by the freeway. $8,000, and we almost got it. We had a cent that he was willing to get. He had $800 for a down payment, and we almost got it. But then we gave it up, you know.
For an office?
It was about 2 acres, 2.5 acres. Yes. We're going to build an office there, you know, right by the freeway. That's the investment alone would have been. But then we cooled off from that, and we're having a lot of cases on, well, you know, on payment, on claim wages.
Who was handling those? The lawyers?
Well, the lawyers, and I was handling some. We're very busy. Building, you know, and it was, we were breaking the barrier. We were getting people coming in on their own. We didn't have to go out so much.
To get members.
To get members, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Emmanuel was here then? No.
No. Oh. When he's away on vacation.
One of his vacations then.
Yeah.
And then the strike, in the month of August, before the strike started, Larry and, what was the name of the other guy? He used to be with Larry.
Ben Gaines?
Ben Gaines came to the office 2 or 3 times. And they, well, intimidated me what they wanted, but they wanted to talk to me. So I told them, very nice, you know. And they were asking me, were we a union? Or, I said, yes, we're a union. Are you going to get a contract? Yes, I'm going to get a contract. And I never asked Larry. I'm going to ask him one of these days. I'm sure that Green had sent him, you know. Anyway, but they never told me they were going on strike, you know. But I knew what they were doing. They were getting large groups of Filipinos together and getting some Arabs. But they couldn't get the Mexicans to come. And their activity heightened our they had, they had four or five organizers here, so their activity, they were going into the fields, you know, and so the activity heightened off our activity. And when the strike started, the Orendains came to the office that morning and said, look, the Filipinos just left, they went on strike. What you were doing? I said, well, what did they tell you? Nothing, they just...
Where were the Orendains? What were they
working,
doing?
They were working in the fields, you know, with one of the Filipinos, with his
Gratan. Oh, yeah? Well, I didn't know that.
I said, well, why did they... They were members before, you know, before the strike started. And I said, well, did they say anything? He said, no, they just walked out. And I said, what are we going to do? So I said, well... I said, I know we're going to have to... We have to have a membership meeting to let you know that we can't, I can't tell you to leave or not, we use your own conscience. So they said, well, we're not going to go work, and they came back and they said, well, we're going to go work. So, well, you know, then we began to, then other groups came all that day, from about 10 o'clock on, they began to come, you know, the same story.
But the Filipinos had not tried to get them to go out, huh?
Well, not to the ones we talked, no, they just walked out themselves. And then, by about 5 o'clock, there were about 100 people in the office, you know.
From different ranches.
Different ranches. Mexicans. What are we going to do, you know? So I said, all right, so go back to work. I thought that was the best way to organize it. Go back to work, and then we'll call a meeting, and then we'll take a vote and see whether, you know, you want to go out and strike supporting the Filipinos and also for your union. And I sent the Lord to talk to Larry. And she and Larry knew one another from before, you know.
Stockton.
Stockton, yeah, they worked together. So we put the machine in motion. We stopped everything. And put the machine in motion to get a meeting.
But Larry didn't come over here. You had to go over there.
Well, that's right. No, I didn't come here. It was kind of, you know.
Yeah, typical.
But anyway, I'll tell you what happened with Green later on. So we put the machinery in motion. They went out on the 8th, this was the 8th. On the 9th in the morning, we put out a leaf at the 9th, yeah. Tell people to stay put, that we're going to take a vote, you know, and then we make Green, he built it up under the radio. And we had the meeting on the 16th. You know, we're going to have it in 4 days, and I said, no, the 16th is the day to have it. And 16th was a Thursday. So we had at the Pius Hall, Catholic Hall here, and we had that place. Were you there? We had the place really jammed up in front, you know, the main hall, and the back hall, and upstairs. People just jam-packed, literally crawling out of the rafters. We registered about almost 3,000 people at night when other organization cards.
Right there at the hall?
Yeah.
Oh,
it was some mess.
If you think of anything, well, you bring it in too, Richard.
The braceros, the police were so frightened they called cops from, I don't know, from as far as Bakersfield. They were just policemen all over the west side. I don't know what they expected, you know. So we...
That's the Pius Falls on the west side.
You say on the west side. And the pressure was from the priest. That's a separate story, you know. A long story in there. Anyway, we had the meeting, we took a vote, and everybody voted. We were single-shotting, you know, for different directions, and then pretty soon we just said, no, everybody, hit everybody. We went out, and we asked for workers from different, we got a whole list of workers, all the ranches, there were workers there, so we told them to stand up, and
You did this at that meeting.
Did that meeting. We took the vote, and the vote was unanimous. You know. Well, you know, we had speeches by the workers, and we got them from one from Jalisco, one from Michoacán, one from.
I remember the speech that Camacho made. He was the one that he really came along with this revolutionary speeches, you know, and you know just.
Yeah. Where was he? Who was he working for?
He was working. We had picked him up. He had become a member. And about 2 weeks later, he's the one that told us about the roses. And he was involved in the roast strike.
Oh, yeah.
He changed from that roast to another, from one roast ranch to another because he was on the strike there, also striking. Mm-hmm. He was a part of the organization.
That was his skill in the roast.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. He was one of those skilled. So anyway, Herman Gallegos came and Hector Abeca. And I think
was Hector still working for UFOC then? I mean, for AWOC then?
No, he was off. But they were still friends, you know. Mm-hmm. And something had happened 2 or 3 weeks before, about 2 months before. And anyway, the Lord seemed to let me.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that was
good.
So she can tell you more about that.
Yeah. I think he was working with the Friends Committee, wasn't he?
Yeah. But I know the Lord refused to let him because they were strong workers. Everybody was saying that.
And what about Herman?
Oh, too.
She kept him out, too?
Yeah.
Oh, great.
In,
That's wonderful. Man.
Yeah. And I think he worked well over there, too. So anyway, things were really rough for them. Well, they got smoothing out as we went, you know.
Things were really rough with them.
Well, but the feelings were hurt.
Oh, those guys, yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, I think I, well, you know.
Sure.
I knew we needed help, so.
Yeah.
Okay. Then,
But it still couldn't have happened to any better people.
Now, you're right, Fred. Then the 4 days, the vote was taken on a Thursday. And I asked two things. I asked him to give me time until Monday morning to go out Monday morning at 5 o'clock to continue working for this Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, 3 days, not to go then. The Monday morning to come to the office instead of Monday to here.
This was 3 days more after the meeting.
And then as soon as the meeting broke, about 10:30, we got on the telephone and began to call. All the guards were awake and they answered the phone and the telephone where they just hung up. And we sent wires that night. Next day we sent letters. We prepared letters that night. And next morning we sent special delivery, return receipt requested.
What did you say in the letters?
It was a letter asking them to meet with us for the purpose of representation, of recognition, and to discuss recognition and also wages, hours, and working conditions. And set the date for them, set the date for Sunday. Set up the deadline for them to answer us on Sunday night.
And it was?
If they didn't, then we would strike them on mm-hmm. Monday morning. Mm-hmm. Then the same day on Friday, we called in the one-armed bandit, the guy from the Conciliation Service.
Oh, yeah. Duncan.
Real guy. And he came in and went around and said a couple of guards. You know, girls wouldn't talk to us. Maybe now that I know Duncan, what he's done, you know, maybe he had a lot to do with that because he was inside, he was looking at us and looking at them. Many people said, well, you didn't have any power, you know, and you're doing your time. Maybe he had a lot to do with that.
You think?
I think so. If I go back, you know, I think that he screwed us up in many, many occasions. Mm. The Lord told me not to trust him enough, but I had to write. I couldn't.
Yes. Yes.
Even when the big teamster fight, the attorney, what was his name? Alex.
Hoffman, yeah.
I walked into a restaurant in Vicente, and there he was, drunker than hell, you know. with some tea, with the tea setting team, with Grammy and maybe by sitting over and by sitting a couple of days before the election.
Before the Georgia election?
And even then, you know, I was president. Anyway, and then we called on the city mayor. I called him to call the doors, and he did. And he almost, no, he didn't. He called, but it wasn't made public, you know, I never got an answer back. But the first week of the strike, he called and offered the city hall for negotiations. And boy, the doors just blasted him, boom, he kept quiet, never again opened his mouth. Only to go, only the following week he opened his mouth to be again to condemn us. I couldn't understand it. He was the liberal of this community, you know, the mayor, voter. He was in the Central Democratic Committee and, you know, the Democratic Party. Before then, you know, he had, a few months before the strike, I had been to see him. He's a very good dentist. And I didn't have a problem with my teeth. So, except for my accident here, but, you know, a decay or anything like this.
Yeah.
But I began to have a problem with one, you know. So I went to see him. He did a very good job on it. He caught it just in time. And so we talked to one another for the first 2 weeks of the strike, and then, of course, the schism and just. Then, I'm telling you an awful story. I'm not telling you, it's disconcerting. I'm not telling you the, you know, it's kind of disconcerting. I'm giving some gaps. Well, we can go through it again.
Do you remember what happened during the next 3 days before you, between the meeting and the actual walkout?
Well, we distributed leaflets. We did an awful lot of work trying to get them to recognize the union or do. We made offers, you know. And the last offer I made to them, to the paper, I think it was to the newspaper, was this was a boot strike. This was on Saturday. I think it appeared on Sunday before the strike. Some to the effect, you know, that if they, I don't know whether it was just before the strike or after the strike. I went as far as long. I went as far as saying, well, if you only meet with us, you know, we're prepared to stop the strike. We're prepared not to strike if you'll only meet with us. And they wouldn't meet with us. Well, not that
wouldn't
I
even repair, wouldn't even reply.
They wouldn't reply. There was only one wrong reply, and this was an absentee landlord whose property was, it was in probate.
Mm.
So the attorney replied. It just that the man had died and the property was being managed by so-and-so and that it was inappropriate. That's the only reply we got. And a few of them refused to accept the letters. And some accept the letter. But no reply. We still have them with everything.
Were you, by that time, then you must have been in touch with Larry during those 4 days before the actual walkout?
No, I wasn't. Dolores was.
No.
But I got the young attorney from Santa Barbara. We used to work with the Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions.
No.
Remember that young guy?
Max something?
No, Richards, no, Richards was his last name.
Oh, is he related to the other Richards?
Yeah, related to Wendy's former boyfriend. Anyway, he came over, so I got him to call Green, and we set up a meeting on Sunday, just before the meeting. Sunday, we were going to walk out on Monday, and we met at 10 o'clock at the motel, at the and we had a very short written agreement. We want to work out with UWOC, with AWOC. We wanted, first of all, a joint strike committee for strategy.
Excuse me, do we want to leave these in here when we do these books or what? And there's a thing on this side too.
Yeah, I guess so.
All right.
Yeah.
Now the ones that we don't have them in, do I have to put them in? Because I just got 10 new ones and I don't have any more of these.
No. It wouldn't have
if they're
to
in there, leave them
yeah.
there. Okay. All right. Because see, there's all sorts of things in here.
It's a good idea.
See, they have send all receipts by the 7th of the... Oh, that's all right. Okay.
What's that?
Petty cash slips they have here. Well, that's all right. We'll leave it on there. Because they've got plenty of instruction sheets. Okay. Excuse me.
Yes. Then,
Caesar, you should get up. It's been over an hour.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm assuming that you didn't get up while I was over there.
No, I didn't.
Okay.
Well, this is sweaty.
Well, do you have that on high?
No, I turned it off because it's getting too hot.
Oh, let's, you remember, we shouldn't leave it on there too long. You know, just rotate it around. How about some of the cream on your back?
Okay.